And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the program. So much to get to, so much to do, so much to talk about. Wow, what a lot. The assault on workers continues. It is Ronald Reagan's 103rd birthday. I wonder what Uncle Ronnie would think about what the GOP has done today. I wonder how the sainted Ronald Reagan would look at the party that idolizes him, that has put him on a pedestal, and well, basically blames everything that they're doing on it was his vision. I wonder what that would be like. I wonder, you go back, and since I actually lived through some of that time, it kind of makes you go, we should maybe look at a real history. For instance, the healthcare laws, Obamacare, part of that you could thank to Reagan, because he did sign the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, which made hospitals actually treat people, couldn't turn them away because they didn't have health insurance, couldn't turn them away because they weren't citizens. Sick people came to the hospital doors. Sick people had to be taken care of. He also pushed something called the diagnosis-related groups, which gave the ability of government to set prices for Medicare. Just saying that maybe we should start thinking about the sainted Ronnie and maybe pull some of the extreme Republicans back from the end of the cliff there. Also Ronnie did push for amnesty, actually signed a bill that gave citizenship to about 3 million undocumented folks here. But they don't hear much about that. Also pushed for an assault weapons ban. Oh, the NRA wouldn't have gone for that, would they have? Not at all. And you hear the people, the austerity party talking about, we need smaller government. Well, we all know that during the Reagan years, government skyrocketed. And so did government spending. In fact, you hear the conservatives all the time saying, well, it was Ronald Reagan who spent the Soviet Union into bankruptcy. Which is their justification why we shouldn't be giving food stamps and unemployment extension and insurance to poor people. Because, those things, we can't have that because bankrupt. Down the line, the fact that, he actually, on some level, even though he was pushing for lower tax rates and lower tax rates, he was anti-loophole. He thought it was immoral. He thought it was wrong that millionaires got away with paying no taxes. And now, understand, he was the guy who, and I don't know if he thought he was the dupe or if he was in on the gig, but the reality is what he pushed has been used so millionaires and billionaires don't pay taxes anyway. And the other one is, this whole, we're weak if we give up, our weapons. He actually attempted to have a nuclear-free world. Actually worked with the Russians. Kicked off the START treaties, if you remember. So, kind of interesting little bit of history on the 103rd birthday of Ronald Reagan, if he were still among us. And I got to wonder how he would feel today as the Senate, the Republicans in the Senate, filibustered just a very simple 3-month extension of unemployment benefits. You got to wonder. They came up one vote short. Harry Reid then changed his vote. You'll see it tomorrow, 58-40. It was actually 59-39. Harry Reid changed his vote on a procedural thing so that, at another time in the future, he'd be able to bring it back up. So that's where that's coming from. But it's amazing to me because Democrats continue. And this, I guess, is, part of what the Democrats do. They capitulate a lot. Whatever you want. We just got to get something done. If it's me right now, if I'm the president, I'm out on the campaign trail. I'm riling unemployed people up. I'm going to rile that 1.7 million people who are right now cut off and the 4 million people who will be cut off by the end of the year. I'm riling them up. I'm getting them to go to the streets. I'm getting them to get involved, to get active, and to be pushing back. And over the next couple of days, we're going to be talking with unemployed workers who, have had enough, just have had enough. Had enough of being demonized, had enough of being degraded, pointed and looked down on. I'll buy our own governor. I mean, the sad reality is our governor himself, they can't pass drug tests.
There are many employers that say, you know, we're looking for people, but we can't find anybody that has passed the drug test, a lot of them. That's
no,
a concern for
concern
you,
for me, yeah.
A serious problem with that.
Oh, it's a serious, serious problem. You look at the facts. Facts are, it's not a serious problem. Not at all. But, you know, it's a good talking point. Because when you can demonize those folks, when you go, well, you know, they're lazy, or they're uneducated, or they're drug addicts. Yeah, that's it. Man, what have we done? What have we done as a working class in this country? You know, I think back to my grandfather, you know, who talked often of class solidarity, talked often of you know, just being a decent neighbor, a decent human being, looking out for your neighbor, because your neighbor's going to look out for you. Like, for instance, you know, just the other day, I was in Harrisburg for the budget speech, and there was a woman who had gotten herself into a real pickle. There's a little alley there in Harrisburg where she had gotten herself stuck, and you go, how did you do that? I still have no idea how she did it, but she had everything blocked up, and everybody's just sitting there watching, a couple people beeping their horn, the people complaining, and I'm looking out the window, and I see this, and I'm going, so I got my coat on, I went out, and I helped push her out of the way. And I'm going, you know, I would want someone to do that for my grandmother. I would want someone to do that for my wife or my daughter. And yet, here you have this line of people who just, nothing, and part of me goes, you know, this is the problem with society. This is what the wealth class, mission accomplished, by the way. Congratulations, Koch brothers. Congratulations, conservative. You're on your own ideology. Congratulations. Because this is what the individual, hooray for me, screw everybody else society now looks like. You got people who are now ticked off. You're in their way. They won't help you, but they'll be ticked off about it. And I look at unemployment as the same thing. You know, I've gotten emails from people going, well, you know, they're lazy. I know people who could work, but they won't. And I say, well, give me their numbers. Let's find out. I'll be happy to go talk to them. And never any of that. Never get any of that. Anyway, we're going to talk about some of that stuff, a bunch more. My outrage of today, and yesterday, I apologize real quick, at the Smith household, insane. Just insanity. The heavy rain, the freezing rain and the snow that brought down a couple of trees at my house. Wow. Good thing is next year I'll have some firewood, I guess. But a little hairy there, a little worrisome. You know, we've got a lot of trees on the one line and my office. And it just was what it was. But I appreciate the well wishes from folks who wished me well via email. But today, my outrage today, and it's one of these, my head was about to explode today. Honestly and truthfully. I you know me, I'm not a fan of privatization. I've yet to find anything as bad as the DMV was, as bad as, you know, the Harrisburg Parking Authority may have been, as bad as any of this stuff is or was, it's infinitely worse in the hands of the private sector. Infinitely worse. Now, let me tell you, I drive a truck on the weekends, and I have a CDL, and the idea is keep the CDL because you never know, might need a job driving a truck, you know, in 2, 3, 5, 10 years, whatever. So you just keep that as a backup plan. So my license is expired. And as anyone knows, anyone who holds a CDL knows, it is a wow kind of process. Full of, you know, I got to go take a test, got to go get my fingerprints, got to go through a terror risk assessment with the NSA and the TSA and the ABC and the XYZ and everybody, FBI, CIA, everybody looking and examining. You haven't done anything yet, but boy, they're looking. Or, no, they're not looking. They're just taking your money, but that's a whole other story. So I'm going through this whole process. I walk in, I take the little test, and then it's, oh, you got to have your birth certificate, social security card, driver's license, underwear size, blood type, all this stuff. And I'm going, I just want to renew my license. And understand, folks who don't have CDLs, it's going to happen to you at some point in the near future. Once we start going, oh, terrorists drive cars. So I had to go get my fingerprints. And this is one of the wonders of being, a terrorist suspect, because every truck driver in the country is a terror suspect. Innocent until proven guilty? Not so much. I'll go get fingerprinted, and then we'll check you out, and then we'll let you make a living. so much for the right wing version of right to work. Anyway, I'm figuring, okay, I'm going to go over to the state police barracks where, you know, I've gone in the past. I'll have to get my fingerprints taken. No state police, no government agency, no law enforcement. The UPS store. I swear. I'm going, what? Not only that, but in order to get my number to be able to go to the UPS store, I had to call another for-profit corporation in Ohio that has the contract for, you know, numerous states across the country where they've consolidated all my information into one call center of moderately paid people who are overworked and understaffed and have to put up people like me who sat for an hour and a half on hold waiting just to talk to somebody to get a number to go give my fingerprints to UPS. Again, I asked the question, who's the idiot who thought privatization was a good idea? So now, and this should scare people, because now it's not my government that holds my fingerprints. It's not my government that holds all of my information, all of my Social Security, my birthday, everything about me. It's not my government. No, no. And this is what I've said from the beginning. I'm not so afraid of government. I'm afraid of these private corporations who are going to, well, profit off of me. So now UPS, the little store there, they've got a little machine that has my fingerprints. So I've got a moderately paid clerk who is taking my fingerprints. And I go back to, is privatization a good idea? Because I'm not seeing it. And I remember back in 92 fighting against the whole CDL idea back then. This idea of a national driver's license. Not against the idea of being tested. I think truck drivers need to have the best skills. But since 9/11, this whole we've got a terrorist might drive a gas truck into a building, so you need to go through, is ludicrous. Let me let everyone in on a little secret. Just a little secret. I'm sure you don't need to be a genius to figure this out. Flying a plane is a lot more difficult than driving a truck. If I were to go and want to blow something up, a CDL is not going to stop me from stealing a gas truck and driving it. I'm not going to go, oh, hey, there's a gas truck full of gas, and there's my target over there, but darn, I don't have a CDL. I'll get in trouble if I drive it. I mean, really? So now what we have is it's about a $100 process to get your CDL by going through your terror risk assessment and your fingerprinting and all of that. And for what? Well, it's the illusion. The illusion that somehow we're going to be safe. And I always go back to what Ben Franklin said. You know, those who are willing to give up liberty for security deserve neither. And we have become such a ridiculously wimpy society. And you know, everybody who just followed in line, nobody had a complaint. UPS store now has my fingerprints. Something seriously, seriously wrong with that. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
I'm excited. Almost to the point of being giddy. It's a relief and just anxious to get it done.
Chattanooga, Tennessee Volkswagen worker Jonathan Walden, reacting to the news that workers in the plant will vote on whether or not to join the United Auto Workers Union. The vote is scheduled for February 12th through the 14th. VW is neutral in the organizing effort. That's important to Walden, who believes the union will win the NLRB supervised election. He says bringing the UAW into VW's Tennessee plant will be good for workers, the company, and the community, and the workers at the plant can't wait to get it done.
Oh, absolutely, Congressman. I have no doubt. The biggest reason that I want the UAW to come in is so that we, as employees of Volkswagen Chattanooga, can fully participate in the Volkswagen system. It's a system of co-determination where management and labor work together to address issues, come up with new ideas, to innovate, just to help move the company forward.
UAW President Bob King says VW is known globally for its system of cooperation with unions and works councils, and the UAW wants to partner with VW and a works council to set a new standard in the U.S. for innovative labor-management relations that benefits all involved. Works councils are used in Germany, but if the workers win and the UAW is authorized to represent them in Chattanooga, this would be the first works council in the U.S. King vowed when elected president of the UAW in 2010 to organize at least one of the foreign-owned auto plants in the South. Anti-union groups are worried that if workers at VW go UAW, other auto plants in the South will follow. Unlike many union organizing drives, this employer is not waging an anti-union campaign. And VW called on all third parties to honor the principle of neutrality. The $8.7 billion cut in food stamps that just passed the U.S. House targets mostly blue states controlled by Democrats. Nearly all of the cuts will come from 16 states that voted for Obama. 28 of the 32 senators are Democrats, so the cuts are targeted overwhelmingly at poor people living in these blue states. Food stamps, known as the SNAP program, were boosted in the wake of the Great Recession of 2008-09. The boost is going away along with more cuts. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, that will leave SNAP benefits for 2013 at less than $1.40 per person per meal. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers has reached a tentative agreement with Alaska Airlines on a new labor contract for 2,500 clerical office and passenger service workers. The agreement includes pay raises and security provisions. The members will be voting on whether or not to ratify the new contract, and the ratification results are expected in early April.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-presented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We need to cut the waste so we can keep taxes down and make sure we have money for critical programs that help our families and our seniors.
I gotta ask, you know, how much more are you gonna put up with? How much more will we take? I mean, it's a good question. You know, how much more of it are we willing to eat? And, you know, I go back to, you know, this afternoon, I go to the UPS store to give my fingerprints to a for-profit corporation who will tell me if I'm a terrorist or not. And John sent me an email during the break saying it's been a couple years that they've done this, part of the outsourcing of all of the functions of CDL work. And I'm going, you know, am I missing something here? I thought this was to keep us safe. I don't feel any safer. I feel actually much more vulnerable that a for-profit corporation has my fingerprints, my Social Security, my birthday, all of my information at a UPS store. It's absolutely insane to me. Just nuts. Anyway, we just heard the governor saying, you know, we need to have money so that we can take care of our seniors. At a time when he was talking about privatizing our lottery, which is what funds our seniors. Kind of makes you wonder about the double standard. On Tuesday, you heard the big campaign budget speech. Here to talk a little bit about that is our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson. Erwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be here, Rick. I'm listening to this other thing that you went through today, and I had no idea that they had outsourced, privatized, and corporatized this process of people securing that which they must have to earn their living. And, you know, when we hear all about what's happened at Target recently and other credit card purveyors, what in the world are these privateers doing to protect and secure your very private and personal information? It's shocking.
That's a good question. Maybe somebody should look into that.
Yeah, I really think so. You know, you would think that our government would not be in the business of compromising the personal security information of its citizens and doing so without us having a voice or a vote. That's an outrage.
Now, I got to be honest. I didn't know it. I was telling my daughter, well, we're going to go over to the police station. You'll get to see the state troopers again. And, you know, maybe they'll put ink on your fingers, all of that stuff. They said, no, you're going to go over to the UPS store. I'm going, I'm not mailing anything. Oh, no. They do that now.
But, you know, we have a law in Pennsylvania that requires people who work in schools, not only school employees, but employees of contractors who may be doing renovations or construction on school buildings to pass a background check. And I wonder if they're going to start contracting that out and compromising that and in the process compromising the safety and well-being of our children.
You got to wonder. I mean, when I signed up because I coach my daughter's basketball team and I had to go through the background checks, you go to a website. And I don't know who administers the website. All I know is I punched in all my information into the website because there's no one to talk to anymore. You can't call someone. You can't go somewhere and fill out a form. You have to do everything on the web. And then they, you know, for 10 or I think it was 20 bucks for the two checks. And they send you your little certificates. And I don't know who does it. I don't know if it's the state police. And I don't know if it's, you know, it's criminals sitting in.
Well, in a prison, sure. You know, doing corporate work while incarcerated. The convict labor game. Who knows? I know that my daughter, who is a speech therapist and pathologist, not only had to go through what you just described, but also had been fingerprinted. And the last time she was fingerprinted, it was at a state police barracks. But I'm just curious now as to whether or not she would have to go to some privateer to get her fingerprints taken and what they're doing to protect and secure that.
No, it's insane. It's just absolutely insane. And I look at this and it's infuriating because all of the things that we've privatized, and none of it, in my view, has done anything good for me. The same thing with the Harrisburg Parking Authority. I got a parking ticket a couple of weeks ago, paid the fine. Now they send me a thing saying, you got to pay me $20 more. Good luck trying to get anyone on the phone. And when you do, oh, our computers are down, or oh, the guy who knows something isn't here. This privatization is the end of our society, in my view.
Well, it's not privatization. I think that is, you know, it's very rare that I disagree with your characterization of things. But it's not privatization, it's corporatization. There's nothing very private about it. We have politicians giving away the public's assets to their corporate buddies. And whether it's the parking in the city of Harrisburg or Corbett's proposal to give away the lottery or our wine and spirit stores, the process is quite the same. And the one group of citizens that's cut out of the process are the citizens, the voters. The owners of these public assets.
Yep.
I mean, the citizens of Harrisburg never got a chance to vote on this Harrisburg Strong program. Yet the privateers have their corporate mitts in the parking. And, oh, by the way, they have increased the prices, extended the hours, decreased the service, and dramatically increased the cost of tickets and fines. And I had an experience earlier this week, just as you were saying, I got a bill from the privateers that are operating the Harrisburg Parking Authority now for my parking space in downtown Harrisburg for a new magnetic card to get in and out of the parking lot. Well, I didn't need a new magnetic card. I had the one that was working for the last 10 years, 11 years. And they sent me a bill for $235, and I tried to call to find out about it. And first, the line was busy, and then the phone rang and rang and rang, and no one answered until the phone company cut off the call. I then sent them an email when I couldn't get through that way, and I haven't heard back on my email any more than you have heard back on my email.
So we're in the
really
same boat.
It's quite frustrating.
Yeah, it's frustrating. And it's not just, you know, it's not just the CDL services. It's not just the parking services. It's basically all of our government is systematically being dismantled and profitized and corporatized and handed off to the lowest bidder.
Well, I don't know that it's handed off to the lowest bidder. It's not like construction where there is a legal framework, if you will, that requires the award to be to the lowest responsive and responsible bidder. These other things are not going to the lowest bidder. They're going to the highest corporate contributor to the politicians that are passing it out. And that's really part of the problem.
That is the problem. So what did you think of the governor's speech on Tuesday? I was underwhelmed by his kickoff campaign speech. I'm just curious your thought.
Well, my initial thought is one of disgust. And I don't say that particularly lightly or in an ill-considered fashion. Just a week before he made that speech, we saw members of his party announcing to all of us that they needed to pass a new law to strip public employees of their right to bargain over issues having to do with how they allocate the money from their paycheck. And the story that the advocates of House Bill 1507, that the governor said he'll sign if it gets to his desk, that restricts and limits the terms of collective bargain, takes away the right to negotiate freely in terms of contract with respect to what I do with my money, were saying that the reason they needed to do this was that they had to get the state and the Commonwealth, and therefore the taxpayers, if you will, out of the business of collecting money for these unions that use it for political purposes. And none of those people that are pushing that legislation, and the governor himself who said he would sign it, saw no irony whatsoever in him commandeering the podium of the capital of our capital to make a grotesquely and openly and notoriously political speech in which he somehow had the colossal gall and chutzpah to suggest that he's the education governor, that he's actually doing something for education, when this is a guy who has stripped methodically $1 billion a year out of public education funding, out of basic education funding in his first budget, and then again in his second budget, and his third budget, another $650 million, nearly $3 billion taken away, and he now proposes by playing kick the can to restore a minor portion of it, and only with conditions, and predominantly going to school districts that don't need the money. And he somehow or another thinks that we're so damn stupid that we're going to forget about it, and he can do so in an overtly political context. That's what I have to say.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you've just reiterated everything I've said for the last couple of days. It was underwhelming, and it was expecting us to have a serious case of amnesia.
Well, a serious case of amnesia, and they are so open and blatant about it that they even hired a George W. Bush political speechwriter to write this guy's speech.
Yeah. Pathetic.
So, you know, it is beyond pathetic. It would be pathetic if we were just afforded the luxury of being casual observers. But we're not casual observers. We're the victim. We're the victim. People are being victimized by this guy and this administration and by his political acolytes. And this is a symptom of that victimization. I, for one, am tired of it. I really am just tired of it. Under the guise of reform, these people, and I've talked about this with you in the past, these people imposed upon us radical changes in our unemployment compensation statute, our unemployment insurance statute, for which every employer and every worker in Pennsylvania pays. And the result of that so-called, what they had, again, the colossal gall to call reform, is that people who work for a living at their occupations, at their trades, when they lose their work, are being denied, stripped of the insurance for which they paid. They are being denied eligibility for unemployment insurance. It's not that their benefits are being limited or cut or restricted or diminished. Their benefit eligibility has been eliminated. It's almost as if you pay for a life insurance policy during your life, and you pass away, and your heirs are told, sorry, the only part of the contract we have to honor is the one where we collected the premium.
It's insane. I mean, and the thing is I don't see that anywhere in the media being talked about other than here on this program.
Well, I don't see it either, except that all of a sudden, intriguingly enough, with this transportation funding that passed a few weeks ago, and the anticipated spring and summer construction season coming up, a lot of the low-wage, rotten-condition, non-union construction contractors have discovered... I'm sorry? Hello?
Okay. Sorry. Keep going. You were going.
Okay. A lot of the non-union construction companies are finding that their former employees have dropped out of the construction workforce because they couldn't keep body and soul together when they, too, were being denied benefits. So all of a sudden, the non-union folks are demanding that somebody do something about the so-called unintended consequence of these changes in unemployment compensation. But it's not an unintended consequence. When the legislation was being debated, the Secretary of Labor and Industry told me to my face that this was going to disqualify 50,000 people a year
wow.
from unemployment compensation eligibility. And now that it's turning out to have happened, they're saying it's, oh, it's an unfortunate unintended consequence.
Absolutely insane. Let's quick go to the phone line, Erwin.
Yeah.
Hey, how you doing? You're on the air. What's on your mind? You there? You there?
Yeah, I'm here. You get, hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay. I was listening to your conversation there earlier about all the requirements for the CDL license.
Yep.
Just like to chip in there, because are you aware that all of that stuff is a result of the rules and regulations coming from the National Relations Board, Labor Relations Board? I'm an employer. And you would not believe all of the stuff we, as an employer, need to go through when we hire someone.
And the National Labor Relations Board has absolutely nothing to do with this requirement. The National Labor Relations Board administers collective bargaining elections and unfair labor practice charges and nothing else.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I don't think this has anything to do with that.
Rick. There's all kind of rulings. There's all kind of things have come down.
You're an employer, sir. Since you're an employer, is your workforce unionized?
No.
Well, then the National Labor Relations Board has nothing to do with your workplace.
Has nothing to do with you.
Listen.
No, I mean, it is what it is. The reality is what it is. Now, if you've got some complaints about all of the rules for CDLs and for that kind of stuff, that's a whole different thing. But in the National Labor Relations Act is for workers. Has nothing. I don't think it has anything to do with the rules of truck driving.
Hang on. Not specifically dealing with truck driving. But through that whole process, there's all kind of requirements that we as employers need to apply by or go by in all of our relationships with our employees. Where do all those regulations come from?
Give me an example of one.
Sexual harassment. Where does it come from?
The EEOC.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then, okay, maybe it's equal. Okay, and maybe it is that. I'm not going to argue with that.
It's not a matter of arguing. It is what it is.
That's what the law is. And if you have a disagreement, if you have a disagreement with the requirements that employers must comply with regarding sexual harassment at work, there's something that you can do about that. But there are really two somethings. One is to petition the Congress, and the other is to make sure you don't sexually harass people on the basis of that characteristic, that immutable characteristic.
Yeah, that's a good point. Give me another one if you've got one real quick.
Wait a minute, Rick. You want to have a conversation, don't you? I would agree. I probably misspoke. A lot of it does come from the EEOC. Now.
But you said it was the National Labor Relations Act and the National Labor Relations Board.
Rick, I misspoke on that.
Okay, okay. Give me another one.
It's actually a combination of the both of them when you put them all together. But
sir. It's not. The National Labor Relations Board has absolutely nothing to do with anything you've said so far. And while I don't know who you are and I don't know what you do for a living, I know what I do for a living, and I deal with the Labor Board on a pretty regularized basis. And the Labor Board does basically two things. One has to do with collective bargaining elections and their administration. The other has to do with unfair labor practice administration, and nothing else.
So give me one solid thing that you think of, because I don't want this to turn into just an argument of throwing things across. Give me one example.
Let me go back to the CDL example and all those things that you had to go through.
That's the Department of Transportation who did that to me, not the Labor Relations Act. It just is what it is. Look, I've been driving a truck for years. I was around in 92 when it started and fought against it then. It's the DOT.
And by the way, the DOT doesn't require the law underlying the DOT requirement of
Congress.
A CDL doesn't require you to go to UPS store to get your license.
Hey, guys, listen, I'm an employer.
Okay.
I hire people. I just hired someone today.
Thank you. Good for you.
Thanks for helping our economy. That's great.
Hang on. But I, as an employer, have got to do all kinds of things to make sure that person is who they say they are, and get them to sign all kind of disclosure forms.
Yeah.
And I have to document all of that.
Okay, but what has that got to do with the National Labor Relations Act? That's not
the
EEOC,
for that matter.
Obviously, you guys do not want to hear from anybody that really don't agree with you.
No, please.
To the contrary, I love to hear from people who don't agree with me. And there's a difference, sir, between disagreeing with respectfully acquired opinions and misstatements of fact.
Rick, how many people do you employ?
I employed two.
Okay. And the other gentleman, how many do you employ?
About 150.
Okay. Well, then, you fully well understand all the requirements that an employer needs to go through prior to hiring someone.
Yes, but back to your original premise, it has nothing to do with the National Labor Relations Act. Now,
and it has nothing to do with the EEOC.
Well, listen, I told you I misspoke on that.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, so we're not talking about the Labor Relations Act, then. You're just talking about regulations in general.
I am talking about the regulations in general.
Okay.
When we as employers want to hire someone, it puts an undue burden. But I can tell you, Rick, a lot of the stuff you were rattling off with the CDL, that comes into play with all kinds of professions today, one way or another.
Now, my complaint had a lot to do with legislation that Congress passed and the privatization of that legislation that made it much more difficult than it has to be. That's a big part of what my complaint was.
Tom, let me ask you a question on this CDL thing, for example. It's a government requirement that over-the-road truckers and bus drivers have a CDL, a commercial driver's license. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So do you think if the government creates that requirement, that it should be the government administering and applying it, or should it be somebody else?
Well, can I give you my opinion? What's happening is trucking companies and those sort of people, then, because they have to do it, they can't do it themselves, so it goes out to private firms to get on behalf of the private individuals.
But
the trucking companies don't have to do it. It's the individuals that have to do
yes.
it. You know, if I'm a driver, like Rick's a driver and he has a CDL, it's his responsibility in order to be able to work at that occupation to have a CDL because the government says he has to have a CDL. So my question to you is, when the government says that, setting aside for a moment whether or not you agree with truckers, truck drivers, operators, bus drivers need to have a CDL to assure that the roads are safe and that their practices are safe and so on. Do you think once the government establishes that standard that the government should be the entity, the group, that administers the requirement and assures that people who are supposed to get those things are getting them?
Obviously, whoever or somebody that creates a set of regulations needs to enforce those regulations and require compliance.
All right. So you agree with us then that the government should be handling it?
No. Well, wait a minute. What my position here is, this is a case of big government creating way too many rules and regulations, and they've done it to the extent where the bureaucracy associated with all that just kind of makes it overwhelming. This is a simple case of big government when too many regulations and with too many different agencies that just simply make it overwhelming.
So what regulation having to do with CDLs would you eliminate to eliminate the overwhelming nature of it?
Listen, I'm not a truck driver. I do not have a CDL license. I am talking about the concept in general. When Rick was telling about all of these things he had to go through, what I'm saying is that is a lot of big government making it very difficult to hire people. And then you wonder why people are not qualified for jobs. There are many people who cannot pass all those tests.
But then do we want them on the road? I guess the other part is, do you want them on the road? And look, I don't know what that has to do with employing someone. As Irwin pointed out so aptly, I'm the guy who had to jump through the hoops. I'm angry they privatized all of it. I was angry in 92 when they passed it, when the Bush administration pushed the national driver's license through. And I was angry during the Bush years when they put this, now I got to go through a terror risk assessment through. But that's also what the people voted for.
But, you know,
go ahead, Irwin.
That's what big government posed upon us.
Well, these particular rules that you're talking about now having to do with the CDL were imposed by the people who were elected on a platform of saying that they wanted smaller government. That was George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. It was in their hands, in their administrations, as they told us that government was too big, that they imposed those standards. But my real question is,
with America that's not the responsibility of the Bushes?
Yeah, all kinds of things. All kinds of things.
NAFTA.
NAFTA's a good place to start. NAFTA's a good place to start, but I'm just trying to hear and listen and respond to what you're asking, sir. My question is, on these kinds of things like CDLs or railroad engineers, locomotive engineers, or airline pilots, do you think that the impediment that you suggest, that people have licenses and meet minimum standards for safety and competence and experience and training, do you think that those are the kind of impediments that are in the nature of over-regulating?
Yes.
Okay. So
yes.
From your perspective, you would have my children exposed to somebody driving several thousand ton rig on a road who have not been certified as minimally competent to handle that rig.
80,000 pounds to be exact.
Well, but listen, this is exactly where.
And I'm just asking you the question. I'm asking you the question. It's a yes-no question.
It does not have a yes-no answer. There does need to be regulation. There does need to be some controls. There does need to be screening. My objection is to the processes and the overwhelming amount of bureaucracy that goes with all of that sort of thing. We are getting into the very same thing with Obamacare right now. There's so many rules and regulations, you have no clue if you're complying with everything.
I agree with you. The best thing would be that the Affordable Care Act that you referred to as Obamacare would have had instead a single-payer plan.
Absolutely.
Where we don't have all of these bureaucracies, where you and I and everybody who's listening to this show aren't required to have not one, not two, but three health insurance policies. One associated with our car insurance, one associated with workers' compensation, and yet another one associated with our general basic health care. And when somebody needs access to medical care, we get three lawyers pointing fingers at each other saying, oh, it was in the car, oh, it was at work, oh, it was not. And the best thing would be a single-payer system where we don't ask people why they need a doctor, but instead we just say, here's the medical care.
And we take it out of the purview of employers. I don't think employers need to be saddled with it.
Guys, who is that single payer? The government.
The taxpayers. We the people.
Taxpayers.
Our government.
Who's the single payer now, buddy? Who pays for
government.
It now? Do you get free health care? I don't.
No, I pay for it.
Right, and I pay for it, too. The only difference is that I don't have a vote about who runs my insurance company. I have a vote about who runs my government.
That's an excellent point.
Hold on. I have a vote with who runs my insurance company, and I vote with who I buy services from. I have a vote.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't like a particular insurance company, I go somewhere else. The issue with single payer and the government is I am forced into that one pot. And by the way, I've had some experience with the single payer or the government doing health care. It's a disaster.
Where's that at?
That's in Romania.
In Romania.
Romania, it's all government health care.
Okay.
And I actually had
family. Was this before or after the fall of communism in Romania?
It was within the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. After the fall of communism. Mm-hmm. Okay?
So could we pick a first world country like maybe Canada?
Yeah, I think we're getting way into the weeds here. I'm going to give you 30 seconds because I really got to take a break here. I love the conversation, but 30 seconds. Give me your wrap-up, Tom.
We have big government that is putting a major damper on business today. It's hurting the economy. It all has to do with overregulation.
All right. There's your point. There's your 30 seconds. I appreciate the thought. Last word there, Erwin.
Well, I'm glad that Tom called in. It points out with great clarity, Rick, one of the most fundamental problems that we have today, and that is the dichotomy, the disparity between the perception of regulation and the reality of regulation. And as long as people believe the lies told by those in public life, we will be condemned to live within a system that fails to deal with the correct and proper analysis and regulatory framework and instead deals in one of platitudes.
I agree with you. That's a good place to end it. Erwin, always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Take good care.
Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com. And click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
I've noticed that local celebrations of Martin Luther King Day tend to be unique, for they've generally not been turned into yet another excuse for beer and barbecue parties. Rather than trivialize the meaning of this courageous man's life, most people treat the day as a moment of serious reflection. Many even memorialize it by vowing to confront the powers that be on some of the big issues that Reverend King asked America to redress, such as entrenched racial inequality and the exploitation of poverty wage workers. But now, I've learned that joining the gritty struggle for justice is not the proper way to honor King. No, no, 'tis a far better thing you do if you just traipse down to a local McDonald's outlet, order a Happy Meal, and join the joyous, integrated Golden Arches family in singing a few verses of Kumbaya. At least, that's what the world's largest hamburger chain urged us to do in a shameless PR campaign. It used this year's MLK Day to try whitewashing its own sorry record of worker mistreatment. One full-page ad pictured three McDonald's crew members, each one a person of color, beaming with delight above ad copy that extolled the corporation's commitment to, quote, a diverse and inclusive workforce. I think Dr. King would have upchucked and asked, what about a workforce that's paid a living wage with benefits so they don't have to work second or third jobs and go on food stamps to subsidize the labor costs of this miserly, super-rich fast food empire? The touchy-feely ad turned to total squish at the end, calling on all Americans to embrace their differences. We can't imagine a better way to honor King's Day than by doing just that. This is Jim Hightower saying, Dr. King, however, had a sharper imagination than that. He would have helped the workers unionize McDonald's to gain real justice for themselves. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. You know, look, you know, it's not a matter of we don't want to have a conversation with Tom. We want things to be easier for employers to employ people, but understand, regulations were put in place mostly for a reason, and as an employer, there are regulations in place that protect workers. And what I found interesting about Tom's original position was, you know, it's about the National Labor Relations Board, which has been the pariah of the right for some time. And, you know, as the right wing throws that out there as, well, this is the red meat of the day, it gets blamed for a lot of things that has nothing to do with them. Understand, the National Labor Relations Act is there to give workers rights on the job because they understand. And this is, I think, something that people need to really understand. Employers in this country have all the rights. I mean, it's odd to me to hear an employer go, oh, there's so many things and they have so many rights. Oh, employers have all the rights. The only right an employee really has in this country, unless, you know, an employer is dumb enough to say, get your old minority behind out of here, or one of the things that are federally regulated under the EEOC or the ADA or some of the other things, employers have all the rights. Workers have one right. And that's guaranteed under the National Labor Relations Act, which is the right to fold your arms and go on strike. But what we've seen lately is employers just locking their workers out, kind of a new little tool, kicking people to the curb, saying, well, you know, hey, there's the door. And what's interesting to me is that, you know, I've heard this, you know, this kind of, this sentiment from people who, the employer class that have, you know, they want no regulations at all. And, you know, there's nothing that they've seen that they agree with. Now, look, am I angry about having to jump through hoops to get my CDL? Yeah. But at the end of the day, the law of the land is what the law of the land was. I didn't sign up to go end up in a private corporation. I didn't say I wanted to give my fingerprints. I didn't want to give my fingerprints to anybody. I haven't committed a crime. But because as a society, we were so afraid. Oh, 9/11, so afraid. You've got to protect us from everything. Part of the Patriot Act, taking, you know, consolidating powers. And this making sure that every truck driver in the country is thoroughly screened, fingerprinted, before they even are even accused of anything, is what I'm angry about. and that we have privatized the core functions of what we, the people, have done. Now, there's a process by which we get rid of regulations, by which we get rid of things. And you know what's interesting to me, today being Ronald Reagan's 103rd birthday, the guy who brought deregulation into our language. It's interesting, after all of these years, we're still hearing the call, we need to deregulate. At what point does it end? Now, for small employers, I do sympathize. Because the big employers have used, and the reason that it's important to remember, H.W. Bush put the CDL into place, and George W. Bush put the terror risk assessment in there, is because they're the ones who keep talking about smaller, less intrusive government, yet what they do is more intrusive. What they do is more in our lives every day. And I got to be honest, you know, at some point you have to call it what it is. Anyway, one of our listeners sent a song that they put together for here in Pennsylvania, a guy named Josh Warden. He's a student of labor and collective bargaining at Penn State's World Campus. And he said, hey, can you play my song? And I said, you know what? I'm gonna premiere his PA union song here on the program. Here's Josh's song.
Puppeteers. 3 years ago, the Koch brothers and cohorts came around, and they started throwing money at the golden diaper crowds. They came to bust your union bit by bit, they chip away. Molly Maguire's who died out there are rolling in their graves. Driven by ideologies of xenophobic men, and they will not rest until they become slave owners again.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
I'm excited. Almost to the point of being giddy. It's a relief and just anxious to get it done.
Chattanooga, Tennessee Volkswagen worker Jonathan Walden, reacting to the news that workers in the plant will vote on whether or not to join the United Auto Workers Union. The vote is scheduled for February 12th through the 14th. VW is neutral in the organizing effort. That's important to Walden, who believes the union will win the NLRB supervised election. He says bringing the UAW into VW's Tennessee plant will be good for workers, the company, and the community, and the workers at the plant can't wait to get it done.
Oh, I absolutely confident. I have no doubt. The biggest reason that I want the UAW to come in is so that we, as employees of Volkswagen Canada, can fully participate in the Volkswagen system. It's a system of self-determination where management and labor work together to address issues, come up with new ideas, to innovate, just to help move the company forward.
VW President Bob King says VW is known globally for its system of cooperation with unions and works councils, and the UAW wants to partner with VW and a works council to set a new standard in the U.S. for innovative labor management relations that benefits all involved. Works councils are used in Germany, but if the workers win and the UAW is authorized to represent them in Chattanooga, this would be the first works council in the U.S. King vowed when elected president of the UAW in 2010 to organize at least one of the foreign-owned auto plants in the South. Anti-union groups are worried that if workers at VW go UAW, other auto plants in the South will follow. Unlike many union organizing drives, this employer is not waging an anti-union campaign. And VW called on all third parties to honor the principle of neutrality. The $8.7 billion cut in food stamps that just passed the U.S. House targets mostly blue states controlled by Democrats. Nearly all of the cuts will come from 16 states that voted for Obama. 28 of the 32 senators are Democrats, so the cuts are targeted overwhelmingly at poor people living in these blue states. Food stamps, known as the SNAP program, were boosted in the wake of the Great Recession of 2008-09. The boost is going away along with more cuts. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, that will leave SNAP benefits for 2013 at less than $1.40 per person per meal. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers has reached a tentative agreement with Alaska Airlines on a new labor contract for 2,500 clerical office and passenger service workers. The agreement includes pay raises and job security provisions. The members will be voting on whether or not to ratify the new contract, and the ratification results are expected in early April.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
John, there's a real difference between venture capitalism and vulture capitalism. The fact of the matter is that he's going to have to face up to this at some time or another.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire. The ring of fire.
Yeah, that's what I'm told. I'm told that it burns, burns, burns as you drink the Freedom Water there in West Virginia. As you know, Freedom Industries dumped a whole bunch of stuff into the American Water Company's waterways. Thus, now we have Freedom Water. And what better marriage of two corporate titans to have this come together for a wonderful toxic product that makes you vomit uncontrollably. And that's the sad part about this. As we see all of this environmental degradation and this destruction, be it in North Carolina, what's going on there with the coal ash, or in Minnesota, or in Mississippi, or Arkansas, or West Virginia, or, you know, here in Pennsylvania. At some point, we the people have got to be saying, you know, enough. Enough is enough, which is why we've asked Jesse Johnson. He is the three-time gubernatorial candidate for the Mountain Party in West Virginia to come talk to us about what's going on in West Virginia. Jesse, thanks for taking time for us.
You bet, Rick. Thank you for having me.
You know, I look at this, and the first question I've got to ask is, what's going on in West Virginia? Is the water safe to drink? I know the governor at one point said, drink it or don't. What do you want from me? Is it?
Well, in the press conference yesterday, where he had some representative from the CDC and from the EPA who were stationed there to assist him. He said, basically, they said that the water was usable. They never said it was safe to drink, specifically, but that it was usable.
What's it usable for?
I'd say it's definitely usable for the two things that... You know, we are not only the mountain state, but we're also known as the birthplace of rivers. And we were reduced for now a month basically to a place where water is only good for flushing toilets and putting out fires, and the exposure to the off-gassing, et cetera, of the flushing of the toilet is potentially causing problems with if the water were hot, formaldehyde, like in a shower, but also a lot of people are suffering nosebleeds, myself included, which I've never had nosebleeds. It's so sad that the birthplace of rivers would be reduced to that. And that's a great indicator of where we're going in this country with our Halliburton loopholes, our disregard for the Clean Water Act, Clean Drinking Water Act, and certainly, the privatization of our water resources, which I've been fighting since my first nomination for governor in 2004, when they were privatizing water, selling it to, at the time, a German. They still have interest, German, the British still have interest in the West Virginia American water. And the privatization of that water resource is why it's even possible to contaminate 9 counties, because they are now pumping water from one source, one plant, to 9 counties.
Wow.
That literally could not have been possible without this privatization scheme that was first implemented by the PSDs that are appointed by the governor, and at that time it was Governor Manchin, who's now the United States Senator.
We just had a caller a little bit ago who, talking about deregulation. Oh, there's too many regulations! And I look at West Virginia and I go, which regulation was too onerous there? Which regulation was it that was supposed to stop the release of all of this, all these chemicals into the water system, even if it is a privatized water system? Where were the onerous regulations then? And I found out that there weren't any.
Correct. That's an ongoing problem here, whether it's we're talking about hydrofracking, or whether we're talking about the coal industry or the chemical industry or anything else. There's a distinct lack of enforcement by the DEP, and as it started under Governor Manchin, this concept of retail government, as if that is the best form of government. I would more characterize that as corporatism or fascism.
So the water is usable, I guess. I guess what they're going to be putting out is, advertisements for buying more bottled water then? I mean, is that the gig? You're not going to be able to use the water that's tapped into your house. We're going to have to buy privatized for-profit water that used to be ours?
Basically, that's the case, certainly for consumption. There's very little. They did a poll yesterday. I believe they released results of the poll at 19% of the people in the affected area are still not using their water, even though they have been cleared in theory to do so. And of course, the governor says, drink at your own risk. And as I said, I believe it was the CDC representative said characterized it as usable water.
Usable. Okay, you can wash your car with it, but good luck having the life-sustaining water that you need. And that's one of the things that gets me. At what point, as we continue to pollute our waterways, at what point does even the private for-profit water, and this is where I keep going back to, regulation is good for business as well, because it's going to stop the bad actors from making things worse. And I look at this and how much contamination. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, home of the Clean Water Act, the river that caught on fire because it was so badly polluted by the steel mills. At what point do these private for-profit companies go, hey, you're screwing up our gig, too? Because I ask the question, is American Water going to sue Freedom Industries?
Well, they obviously won't get much out of them if they do, considering the fact that they had already reorganized a matter of weeks prior to the admitted spill. All of the data First it was that morning, the night, then it became, well, now it's gotten to the point where, as they say, that it happened at least 20 hours prior. But I've talked to families in the neighborhood that surrounds that company, and they say that that it was, well, at the very least, that it was leaking prior to that the smell was present, and that's another problem. But the smell was present prior to December 1st, and at most, potentially early last summer, almost a year ago.
So nobody really knows how long it has been. These spills have been going on. It's just now that finally someone caught on to it. It's become a thing, and that's the thing that gets me. I mean, you see a lot of this stuff that happens, and which is why I'm a firm believer in having much more stringent regulation and inspections, so that we catch these things earlier. Especially, you know, here in Pennsylvania, you think we would have learned the lesson from the coal industry. Yeah, we don't seem to. The fracker's gone. Drill, baby, drill. Don't worry about those rules. Just drill your brains out.
Right, and we have the least most lax regulations in you know the entire Marcellus Shale. So presently, you know, this is fracker's paradise, the gas holes.
So. You know, as we look at all this stuff, I mean, as, you know, as someone who spends a lot of time thinking about this, I mean, you see all of these spills going on. You see all of these environmental catastrophes going on. The talk of the Keystone XL pipeline being built. You know, what's the average person to think? I mean, we're inundated with all of this. You know, here in Pennsylvania, we got a governor saying, oh, it's creating millions of jobs. Everything's wonderful. And what's the average guy to think who's getting that sound bite in his ear all the time saying, oh, it's fine, don't worry about it, it's creating jobs, it's good for the country, we need it? What's the average guy to think?
Unfortunately, Rick, you know, they don't have, and we certainly don't have, a good independent media like source like you. We have, you know, bought paid for media that is subsidized probably 80% by the very industries that are committing these crimes against people. So, you know, I mean, this is a growing problem, and there's really no end in sight until this. Now you have 300,000 people plus in West Virginia, the capital city, you know, the financial hub and epicenter, that are now starting to feel the pain of the smaller, communities, from southern West Virginia that were coal communities, whose water was poisoned by sludge injection wells, slurry injection, you know, Printer, Rawls, Merrimack, Sprigg, all of these townships that lost their water, where, nearly 80% of them have no, of the actual population has no gallbladder. Where they have all kinds of elevated forms of cancer.
Kidney problems.
And now all of these, you know, all of these people are starting to feel a certain kinship. And as well, for those folks, as well as people along Route 50, which stretches from, you know, just outside of D.C. All the way to the Ohio River. And you know, that is frack central for West Virginia now, where these companies have come in and just taken over community after community, basically strong-arming the county commissions, informing them that they will bankrupt them if they fight them on it with any regulation pertaining to their ability to drill in the middle of a floodplain and that sort of thing. It's dreadful, and as well as, you know, the lack of responsibility of lawmakers to at least insist that they identify the chemicals. You know, right now we don't even know what chemicals to be testing for. And the MCHM is breaking down into other compounds as well as creating new. And we have no idea and are not testing for the toxicity.
That's because we don't need any stinking regulations, Jesse. We don't need it.
Right.
We like our freedom water. We like our toxic sludge. We like our uncontrollable vomiting. And what's interesting to me, Jesse, is when we met over the summer, we went into Blair, West Virginia, where we met the Friends of Coal people who came out with their sidearms and all of that. What I remember being struck with is this feeling that those poor folks have been handed nothing but false choices every step of the way. They've been told the only thing that they can possibly have is either coal or the drilling or all of this stuff that is eventually going to kill them. So their choice is you die a slow, painful death of your kidneys being screwed up, your gallbladder going, all your insides being mucked up, or you starve to death. Those are your choices.
Well, that's absolutely right. And one of the amazing things, though, that I'm noticing, this is cutting, here in the capital city, this is cutting across all political lines, all even ideological lines. I was talking to some extremely self-proclaimed capitalists who are strong believers in business and certainly not labor, but at the same time, they were saying that these kinds of things, our utilities, should be controlled by the government and overseen by a government that actually, writes up violations and fines those who need to be fined and takes care of the community that comprises it.
Yeah.
It's really, we're in a strange time in this country, as you well know. And in 2007 and 8, I visited 16 states, and I kept telling them, the company town is coming to your community.
Yep.
And this, we've seen what's happened in Milwaukee, public workers. We've seen what's happened with actual democracy itself in Detroit. And now you've got this kind of contamination with chemicals that have never even come into contact with human beings before on this level. And the data that we're seeing is not looking good. I'm just now getting wind of some of the National Science Foundation is doing testing put out some rapid response grants. And the first data tests that are coming back are not good. And people are very frightened. Young mothers, young families are plotting their way out of here. And frankly, I'm not so sure that that's not what the industry, embraces. I had on my websites and my prior campaigns, my 2010 U.S. Senate bid against Manchin, a coal industries depopulation plan for southern West Virginia. Well, this along with hydrofracking has the potential, unregulated at this point, to cause a depopulation of the entire state.
Yeah, you didn't even mention the mountaintop removal yet, and that's the other part of it as well.
Right. Well, that's why it was really the depopulation plan that was done up in the early 90s, was really focusing on the mountaintop removal. But I'm just saying that, their vision is coming to fruition, strangely enough. It's bad for business. It's bad for all these businesses in the valley of what I'm now referring to as Death Valley East. It's very sad, and people are very frightened, and it's not going to be good for businesses. It's not going to be for homeowners, all the things that big business says that it is for, property ownership, private ownership, et cetera. Well, they're losing the value of everything.
Yeah.
And, when we go to other, planets, when we shoot probes into space, what are we looking for? Water.
Yep.
And we were birthplace of rivers, and look at what we have done with our neglect. And it's not just neglect, it's constructive neglect. And that's what I've been fighting tooth and nail for a decade.
Now, Jesse, I appreciate you taking time for us. I'd love to have you back as this continues down the road to give us updates on what's going on. And you're absolutely right. It's the water. I've been saying for years, oil, we're not going to fight wars over oil anymore. We're going to fight wars over survival and water. Jesse Johnson, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick, and I always appreciate getting to talk to you, and I appreciate some honest media out there.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
I've noticed that local celebrations of Martin Luther King Day tend to be unique, for they've generally not been turned into yet another excuse for beer and barbecue parties. Rather than trivialize the meaning of this courageous man's life, most people treat the day as a moment of serious reflection. Many even memorialize it by vowing to confront the powers that be on some of the big issues that Reverend King asked America to redress, such as entrenched racial inequality and the exploitation of poverty wage workers. But now, I've learned that joining the gritty struggle for justice is not the proper way to honor King. No, no, 'tis a far better thing you do if you just traipse down to a local McDonald's outlet, order a Happy Meal, and join the joyous, integrated Golden Arches family in singing a few verses of Kumbaya. At least, that's what the world's largest hamburger chain urged us to do in a shameless PR campaign. It used this year's MLK Day to try whitewashing its own sorry record of worker mistreatment. One full-page ad pictured three McDonald's crew members, each one a person of color, beaming with delight above ad copy that extolled the corporation's commitment to, quote, a diverse and inclusive workforce. I think Dr. King would have upchucked and asked, what about a workforce that's paid a living wage with benefits so they don't have to work second or third jobs and go on food stamps to subsidize the labor costs of this miserly, super-rich fast food empire? The touchy-feely ad turned to total squish at the end, calling on all Americans to embrace their differences. We can't imagine a better way to honor King's Day than by doing just that. This is Jim Hightower saying, Dr. King, however, had a sharper imagination than that. He would have helped the workers unionize McDonald's to gain real justice for themselves.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Bonnie sent me an email during the break saying, you know, you hit it right on the head, false choices. All we seem to get anymore are false choices. And she's absolutely spot on. We keep getting these false choices of, you know, do you want to die a slow, painful death from chemical poisoning of years and years of consuming the water that's been spilled into so we can have jobs? Or do you want to starve? And, you know, there are alternatives. You know, there are. And, you know, the Keystone Pipeline XL, you know, this Keystone Pipeline thing, another one of those false choices. So, you know, the other day as I'm chopping up wood because I had trees falling down from the weather that we've been having, and we've just been having really bizarre, massive shifts and swings in temperature and precipitation and huge, huge storms, which, you know, I'm told, look, I'm not a climate scientist, but it makes sense. It's all part of the climate change and all of the things that, you know, they've been saying for years that we should be thinking about getting away from fossil fuels and we should be thinking about doing some alternative things. But we're not given those choices. We're continually given false choices. The choice of, well, if you don't have any oil, our economy is going to die and we're going to all stand outside and we're going to look at each other. When the reality is look, you know, even Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, said, you know, we'll adapt, we'll figure things out, we're smart people. Why can't we figure out how not to get ourselves into this mess? Why can't we figure out to go, hey, look, if we can come up with the latest, greatest widget that's going to produce energy, that is going to get us off of the fossil fuel and get us out of the Middle East and out of all of this environmental degradation and all of this chaos and turmoil and destruction and all of that. Why shouldn't we? Oh, I know why. You know why we don't do solar panels? Honestly and truthfully, the big energy companies haven't figured out how to charge you for them yet. They really haven't. They haven't figured out how to give you, how to have you give them money every month for the solar panels that you put on your house. That's it. All of the renewable alternative energies, they haven't figured out how to really profit from yet. That's it in a nutshell. Look, I mean, you want to talk about actual choices? We don't get actual choices. I can buy a car that is a diesel or a gasoline engine. I mean, you could make the argument, sure, you get an electric car, sure, but where are you going to plug it in? You're going to go to work, where are you going to plug it in? You're going to go down the road, go to the mall, where are you going to plug it in? You know, they're talking for years about hydrogen cars. Okay, great, let's have a hydrogen car. What the heck, let's try it. Well, where are you going to fill up? All of the infrastructure that's paid for by you and me, understand that. When they build this stuff, it's all written off, and anybody who gets the business angle of things knows that everything's, you know, depreciation and cost and all deductions and all ways of avoiding paying taxes. We pay for it. So we've got this huge infrastructure that's been built through massive subsidy also. What choice do we have? I mean, the right loves to talk about choice. Give me choice. You know, here in Pennsylvania, they talk about choice. Wow, we've deregulated electricity. Okay, well, where's my choice? I still have to get electricity off the same power lines that my tax dollars paid for. Well, my great-grandparents' tax dollars and my grandparents. You know, all through the 40s, when the electrification and all that stuff with Truman and all that, especially where I live. Because I doubt that they would have electricity to this day if it weren't for Truman making it happen. Just a thought. But, you know, where's my choice? There's no choice. There's the illusion of choice. We have a lot of illusions. The illusion of safety, the illusion of choice, the illusion that, wow, there are too many onerous regulations. And look, you know, the little guy, you know, the small employers who do, you know, I can see where you say there's too much. I can see too much compliance. I get it. But if you're doing the wrong thing, then, yeah, that's what's going to happen. And you know what's interesting? You know, going back to the Freedom Water, and Jesse hit out there for a second. I didn't jump on it. American Water, which I find odd, they're not going to be able to sue Freedom Industries because they're broke and there's no money there. So who are they going to go after? Oh yeah, the ratepayers. Oh yeah, the taxpayers. Oh yeah, we the people. Not Freedom Industries. Oh no, not with their flag waving. No, no. And this is what happens when you have no regulation on a company that's struggling to make ends meet and is cutting every corner possible. And you have no oversight to make sure that they're following the rules. And when they're not, we don't catch it for months, weeks, or even years. So look, you know, we can argue that there are too many regulations. I think there are too many in some cases. But in other cases, there are not nearly enough. And when you go back to the deregulation argument, we haven't really deregulated since the days of Reagan. What we've done is we've allowed the big corporations, the big special interests, the billionaire class to re-regulate, which means they've turned those regulations against we the people in their best interests. That's what it's really about. And again, time after time after time, we're given false choices. It's that simple. False choices. where if you sit down and you honestly talk to people about what direction should we be going in the country? Should we be using more fossil fuel? Most people go, if there's an alternative, we should, in a common sense way, go towards it. Now, when people hear me say we should be moving away from the juice and looking for alternatives, they say, oh, you just want to chuck everything and you know, fly windmills. Well, I'm not against windmills. I think they're kind of neat looking, and they do produce some energy, and we used to do some hydroelectric and, you know, stuff like that. There are alternatives. And in a society full of intelligent people with smart leaders, that's our problem. I don't think we vote for the right people. I do believe, could be that country that does big things again. I fundamentally believe that. Anyway, as you've heard, as I said at the beginning of the program, no unemployment extension benefits thanks to our GOP friends. And it came down to a handful of Republicans that refused to stand with the Democrats and get over the cloture vote, which means, again, we've seen another filibuster. Which, again, we've seen another, anything that gets done has to be done with a super majority, which is why I hope come November we will remember this. Come 2016, I hope we will remember Pat Toomey voted against it today. I hope that we will remember all of the things that our Republican friends have done over the last couple of years as they brought us austerity, as they brought us brinkmanship, hostage taking, and all of the wonders. And look, you know, the hostage thing probably could still happen with the debt ceiling. I'm hoping that good, honest, decent Republicans take their party back in a sane direction, especially today on Ronald Reagan's 103rd birthday. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
Policeman, a union man, brother firefighters, my friend. And the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not going to break tonight. And we're not going to bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around. And everybody said, this is a union town. A union town. All down the line, this is a union town, a union town. All down the line, they can't if they come to strip our rights away. We'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
I'm excited. Almost to the point of being giddy. It's a relief and just anxious to get it done.
Chattanooga, Tennessee Volkswagen worker Jonathan Walden, reacting to the news that workers in the plant will vote on whether or not to join the United Auto Workers Union. The vote is scheduled for February 12th through the 14th. VW is neutral in the organizing effort. That's important to Walden, who believes the union will win the NLRB supervised election. He says bringing the UAW into VW's Tennessee plant will be good for workers, the company, and the community, and the workers at the plant can't wait to get it done.
Oh, absolutely, Congressman. I have no doubt. The biggest reason that I want the UAW to come in is so that we, as employees of Volkswagen Chattanooga, can fully participate in the Volkswagen system. It's a system of co-determination where management and labor work together to address issues, come up with new ideas, to innovate, just to help move the company forward.
UAW President Bob King says VW is known globally for its system of cooperation with unions and works councils, and the UAW wants to partner with VW and a works council to set a new standard in the U.S. for innovative labor management relations that benefits all involved. Works councils are used in Germany, but if the workers win and the UAW is authorized to represent them in Chattanooga, this would be the first works council in the U.S. King vowed when elected president of the UAW in 2010 to organize at least one of the foreign-owned auto plants in the South. Anti-union groups are worried that if workers at VW go UAW, other auto plants in the South will follow. Unlike many union organizing drives, this employer is not waging an anti-union campaign. And VW called on all third parties to honor the principle of neutrality. The $8.7 billion cut in food stamps that just passed the U.S. House targets mostly blue states controlled by Democrats. Nearly all of the cuts will come from 16 states that voted for Obama. 28 of the 32 senators are Democrats, so the cuts are targeted overwhelmingly at poor people living in these blue states. Food stamps, known as the SNAP program, were boosted in the wake of the Great Recession of 2008-09. The boost is going away along with more cuts. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, that will leave SNAP benefits for 2013 at less than $1.40 per person per meal. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers has reached a tentative agreement with Alaska Airlines on a new labor contract for 2,500 clerical office and passenger service workers. The agreement includes pay raises and job security provisions. The members will be voting on whether or not to ratify the new contract, and the ratification results are expected in early April.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Got an email from Brian yesterday that one of those moments where you go, are there people that really think this? I guess just regurgitating what the right-wing anti-worker frames have become. But he writes, and I quote, "Why would anyone want to work when Obama is giving out so many goodies?" He writes, if you're collecting unemployment, you get health care that most workers don't. You get food stamps that the rest of us pay for, and all kinds of free stuff that actual working people have to pay for. And I read this, and I'm going, you know, are there people who actually believe this, or is it they've just been inundated with this kind of message? Look, you know, we've got a governor who threw out this frame that you got to love.
There are many employers that say, you know, we're looking for people, but we can't find anybody that has passed the drug test, a lot of them. That's a concern for me because we're having a serious problem with it.
It's the old, first lazy, stupid, and then a whole bunch of free stuff. Remember after Romney and Ryan lost, the sore losers said it was because Obama was giving stuff to the urbans?
And that's been the frame. And I got to be honest, I'm surprised he didn't throw out the Pete Sessions line we talked about yesterday, that extending unemployment benefits, immoral. Figure that one out. Anyway, as you know, it did not pass the Senate 58-40. Actually, it was 59-39. Harry Reid, last second, changed his vote to a no vote so that he'd be able to bring it up later down the road. But here again, can't get past cloture, can't get past the filibuster, which makes you go, should we be reforming these filibuster rules? But here to talk to us about her experience and what the lap of luxury and how wonderful it is to be unemployed. Sherry Minikoff has come and talked to us about her situation. Sherry, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for helping us bring attention to this.
So Brian believes that it's a life of luxury that you get health care when you're unemployed.
This has been the single most stressful time of my life, and when I was collecting the paltry $300 a week for me and my child, we actually make too much money to qualify for health care, food stamps, and anything else you can think of. There is no help. It is not fun.
So this frame that we keep hearing, and we hear it a lot, that, you know, if you're long-term unemployed, there's got to be something wrong with you. Either you're lazy or stupid or a drug addict. I've talked to so many people here recently that they don't fit into any of those categories. Before the program, before you went on, we talked for a couple of minutes. I don't get that sense from you either.
Now, I'll tell you a little bit about my story, which is not unique, but it's my story. And I dedicated myself to the nonprofit sector because I wanted to make a difference, and I feel like I'm being punished now. I lost a nonprofit job in January of 2009 due to Bernie Madoff, and it was a large mass layoff, and I was off for 2.5 years then when the economy was extremely turbulent and used up every penny I had of retirement, of savings. My son helped work to support us. I found a job that paid substantially less, but I took a job to take a job. Another nonprofit job, and was laid off last January 31st because of funding issues.
Right.
And I have no cushion because I went through every penny the last time. My son went to use his part-time money to help us, and it is not easy. There are no jobs to apply for.
And
I'd only be so happy to work.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that I think people need to understand is right now, statistically, there are more than three people out there scrounging and fighting for every available job. And look, there, a lot of them, you've got these frictional barriers, these structural barriers, beyond the fact that you've got so many people who are looking for work, and you've got employers who are being extraordinarily choosy. And if you've been off, for 10, 12, 20 weeks, they don't even look at your resume anymore, from what I understand.
And I would also add to that, not only has the job search changed, networking is taboo. It's just go to the internet, email me, don't bother me.
No.
It's also the jobs, because everybody's downsizing, they're combining two and three jobs. So you may be qualified for 70% of the job, but you don't know the other 30%. And they get downsized the salaries. And how are older workers with responsibilities and children in college? They can't work at $25,000.
Yeah.
You just can't downsize certain expenses at certain points in your life.
So when you hear a frame like Brian threw out here that, everything's wonderful and Obama gives out all these you get the Obama goodies and you get all of these things because, you didn't want to work anyway. How does that make you feel? I mean, what do you say to someone like Brian? I mean, I've got a couple of choice words because I've been unemployed in the past and I've felt that desperation, that isolation that comes with being unemployed. I know what I would tell him, but I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Obviously I'm angry. I fight being depressed, being despair. I volunteer, which keeps me sane a little bit and helps me be a productive member of society and keep my skills and learn new things, so I am relevant in the workforce. It is no bed of roses. I would like him to walk a day in an unemployed person's life. There are no handouts. Nobody's helping you. I live on cheese sandwiches. It's not an easy life. I don't know where he thinks this lap of luxury is. I haven't had a vacation in 6-7 years. When I take my son to college, I can't be like other parents and stay and help him. I drive 13 hours, drop him and run because I can't afford to stay in a hotel and be a normal parent. These are little things that make big differences.
I mean, it's huge to me. But, the thing that gets me is you've got folks like Brian who've probably never been there and honestly don't think that they could ever be. So one of the questions that I ask folks who have been unemployed for a period of time is, did you ever think you would find yourself in this situation? Did you ever think it could happen to you? Because I hear it a lot. Can't happen to me. I'm invaluable. I'm you can't replace me. And yet I talk to so many people who, they thought that, but sadly they're in this situation the same as you are.
There is no job security any longer. There's no loyalty, and the employers want to hire for the least expensive, the youngest, because they feel they can get more out of it, that experience doesn't count. And it's just, I don't know how to respond to people who are basing their opinions on lack of knowledge.
That's a good point.
There is no argument. I don't go anywhere. I don't go out. There is no money. This is not fun. And trust me, you can be a couch potato for a day. After that, you want to hurt yourself. This is not fun. It is. Unemployment is not a bullet here. Nobody wants this life.
No, I'm with you.
Nobody wants to feel invaluable, that they're not contributing, and certainly $300-some a week. I don't know who can live on that.
Of which our governor here in Pennsylvania and the Republicans who lead our General Assembly, they went back in 2011 and changed the unemployment rules to where a large number of people are excluded because of the work that the kind of work that they do. And if they work make most of their money in two quarters, they're ineligible. Also froze that benefit for the next decade, which, you look at this and you go, you froze that meager benefit for the next decade so that it's eroded by inflation. What happens to the person down the road?
And if I may digress a little bit, I would like to hear from Senator Toomey, who voted no. And I would like to hear from him and his colleagues who voted no. Why? They will not tell us why they voted no.
Were you surprised that he voted no? Because I wasn't. Because here's why. If you go back and you look at the housing crisis, if you remember his statements after the housing bubble burst back in 2008, 2009, he said he would have wanted a much harder down. which means that he doesn't believe in any social safety net, any help for people, and that, you know, if you're falling, you should free fall to the bottom. You should hit rock bottom, and then you build yourself back up. That's his worldview. So it's not really surprising to me that he wouldn't extend a helping hand to folks who are desperate and need it now.
And I have two responses. I can't job hunt if I don't have a roof over my head and if I don't have electricity. So I end up in a homeless shelter on welfare. How is that helping anyone? My son gets pulled out of college. How does that help the future? How does that help him? And he can't contribute to society.
It doesn't. It's this tip-of-the-nose type of austerity that we get from a number of folks in our government. This idea that we're not going to lend that hand, we're not going to invest in people's future job training, all that stuff. It just seems this piece of legislation, which Republicans said they would pass if it was paid for, they would pass if it was a short duration. Here it is, short duration, paid for. They still voted no.
And it's not our fault that we lost our jobs. It is not, none of us, people who are collecting unemployment were not fired because they were derelict in their duties or they embezzled funds.
That's an excellent point.
People lost jobs through no fault of their own because there were budget cuts, because of the downsizing. I'm sure there's a multitude of reasons. And jobs are not being created, but yet they won't help us job search. And I can't job search from a street corner. And I don't know what they expect us to do.
You know, I want folks who have jobs today to think that, you know, at any point, this could be you. This could be me at any point, because I don't know if you've seen the reports recently, but in the next 20 years, half of the jobs that we have today, half of the people who are employed today will not have jobs because those jobs will be mechanized. They will be done by robots, by computers, by all kinds of other things but humans. And the question then, in my view, becomes what happens, what do we do for folks who there are no more jobs for? And to me, I'm of the mindset that government should at some point step in and be employer of last resort to make sure that people don't lose their skills don't go away, and that they have that dignity and self-worth that I do believe comes with work.
I agree with you. It's not our fault that the economy is in the shape of it.
And I look at you as someone, you know, thanks to Bernie Madoff, I mean, you're the guy who, the huge Ponzi scheme, billions of dollars, he bilked out of taxpayers and out of folks, and here you are now still suffering the consequences of the power of this one guy that we allowed to have without regulatory oversight or without anybody really paying attention.
Absolutely. And I'd like to know, and in regard to the gentleman who emailed you, I have 27 years of administrative experience, 25 of them in the nonprofit world, and I'm still not marketable. Is that my fault? I have not been laying around for 27 years. I've been trying to work, raising my son on my own after my divorce. What more can I do?
So what should we be doing? I mean, I know the three-month extension is a short-term fix that's going to get you to tomorrow, but what about 3 months from now? I mean, a month and a half, because December 28th, they fled Washington for home. While leaving, let me ask you about that, because that's got to be a kick in the gut, not just a lump of coal in your stocking, but really a kick in the gut to have our elected officials flee their jobs that we're still paying them for without actually doing their job.
I'm not going to go there and take an hour of your time, but what I would comment, besides the holiday, it is the single worst time in the year to job hunt.
Exactly.
There have not been new job postings, I would say, a week or so before the holidays and up until even now. And with the weather being the way it is, there's no job. I can't even apply for jobs. I can't even help myself. No. How is this my fault?
And the other part of this is you've been, you know, now that we're into this extended period, you've been unemployed past the 26 weeks. Which, you know, studies, you know, have shown, you know, it gets infinitely harder once you get past that period. Have you run into those situations? I would assume maybe you got a couple of calls early on. Anything recently?
Honestly, I don't think that's my problem. I've managed to stay relevant in that world and doing a little bit of consulting work in the nonprofit world.
Good.
So I don't think that's my issue. What my issue is, my age, being 50, and having all this experience, people look at me, I'm too qualified, I'm overqualified, and I've been offered jobs $20,000 a year. I mean, not only is that an insult, but that's not going to help me. And that's the problem out there. They don't want to pay the more experienced workers
right. What
we need. You know, a 20-year-old can live on $20,000. 50-year-old with a college-age student can't. therefore, that, oh, there's all these jobs out there. Working at retail is not going to pay my rent.
No, and that's the other part of this. What we need to be talking about is, you know, what kind of jobs are out there? You know, I don't know very people who can afford to exist, survive, or let alone live and prosper on McDonald's or Walmart or retail, big box retail or fast food wages.
And they won't even look at me because I'm too experienced. You're too qualified. I don't know what the fear is, but I'll.
Well, you'll leave.
Exactly. And no one will even give me a chance. So it's just, I worked hard to work myself up the ladder, and now those jobs are gone. And people and I apply to any job that my skills will transfer, and I'm just told you're too qualified. We don't take nonprofit. Your skills don't transfer. You don't have this experience. They have every excuse in the book.
Other than just coming out and saying what probably really is the fact. We're looking for younger.
Right.
And that's the sad of this.
How do you overcome this? This is not my fault. It's not for lack of trying. It's not for lack of effort. But yet they won't vote to extend unemployment so that I can keep trying. And I have not given up through all of it.
So we call Toomey's office. We yell. We holler. We complain. At the end of the day, though, doesn't it come down to the folks that we've put into elected office? Doesn't it come down to our governor, to our legislature, to the people who are sitting in Congress?
I blame everyone. They're all, I don't care what party they belong to. Everybody is responsible for what's happened. I know it's not a pretty thing to say, but it's the truth.
No, I mean, look, I haven't seen a jobs plan, but the reality is, and I appreciate your view if it's down the middle, but on this issue, this is most certainly a faction of one political entity, and that's the extreme wing of the Republican Party, the party of austerity and the party of no. We have seen no investment. We have seen no jobs plans. You know, the transportation bill our governor and the Republicans put through was paltry compared to what the governor's own commission said was needed. And to me, I'm of the mindset that this government has to be, if the private sector refuses to. And look, if you see the profit margins, you see the amounts of money that these big corporations are sitting on, it's not because they're struggling and they're trying to pinch pennies that they're not hiring. It's because they don't want to. And at that point, I think government then has to step in.
Good point.
And it is that simple. Sherry, I appreciate you coming and talking to us. I appreciate the bravery and the will. Last question I've got for you. You know, what do you think it's going to take? Because, you know, I go back to the 30s. I go back to the Great Depression where, you know, you had hundreds of thousands of people across this country in the streets. We've got 23 million unemployed. We've got 1.7 million right now who have been cut off of the federal unemployment extension benefits. Is it going to take people going back to the streets like during the Depression? Is it going to take people tearing things up like during the Depression and making the wealth class of this country fear that their heads could end up on sticks?
Perhaps. I think there's a move. I've been watching. I've been monitoring Twitter and Facebook, and I think there's a move being generated for the unemployed. And, you know, they forget we have time on our hands.
Yep.
Sit on the computer and motivate and move. And people, there's this movement out there I've been reading that they want to go plant themselves and protest at all their home district offices.
And they should. I mean, you know, I go back to one of the things that I've said was the worst thing that happened to the unemployed is they closed all the unemployment offices. Because that used to be the place of organizing. That used to be the place where you saw the unemployed. What's happened is folks like you have been pushed to the periphery, kind of an out of sight, out of mind thing. And I've been saying for a couple of years now that what needs to happen is folks like you need to stand up and say, here I am. You better do something about it. Camp out in D.C., camp out in Harrisburg, camp out in district offices, get to the street.
Well, and I'd like to see the statistics, and no one will produce them. You know, unemployment costs X amount of dollars per week. You know, it's hard on the economy going into debt. I'd like to see how much it's costing them for people to go now on food stamps, to go on welfare insurance, to get subsidies, to get Section 8 housing, if they can even apply. If you can get through the phone to the welfare people who are hiding.
Oh, don't get me started on that.
So I would like to see how those numbers are going to hurt. And then they're going to blame the president and say, oh, you're giving all this welfare money away. No, by turning down unemployment so I can pay my bills, people have to go on welfare, go into shelters, which are subsidized.
Well, here in Pennsylvania, since December 28th, 73,330 people have lost their federal extension benefits. You are one of those 73,330.
May I update that? It's 91,000.
Oh, 91,000 now. See, every week it changes because the further along we go, these are the numbers I have. Now, we're talking some $30 million out of our economy, which I would argue is going to make our unemployment situation that much worse. As that money's pulled out of the economy, you end up with more people out of work.
Absolutely, because people use their unemployment to pay bills. Some people pay their rent. Some people go to Target. Some people go to the supermarket. Some people pay for medicine. That is generating income. If nobody has this money, it's not being spent. And then people at those stores are going to be laid off.
Exactly.
And it's a vicious cycle that no one is seeing.
And they don't go. They don't go to the Cayman Islands, and they don't hide their money in offshore accounts.
There is no money to be had.
That's exactly it. Sherry Minkoff, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thank you once again, and I wish you nothing but the best in your job search, and I hope you'll come back and talk with us again at some point in the near future.
Absolutely, and thank you for helping us bring attention to this.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Sherry. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You could always speak your mind. You work so hard to say what's right. I watch you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Night and 3 hours every night here on the big program, and you know, you listen to that, and it's, you know, to me, nothing more despicable, disgusting. And you know, I'll leave you this hour with an interesting quote by one of John Boehner's biggest allies, Patrick Tiberia. He said that right now Jesus himself couldn't be the speaker and get 218 Republicans to get behind something. He's talking about immigration, but you know, you go back and you look at, you can talk about whatever. You can talk about unemployment benefits, jobs programs. It doesn't matter. The Republicans are so splintered, and it's, in my view, it's the spattering of huge amounts of campaign cash with the idea that if you keep government gridlocked, if you keep government weak and at each other's throats, well, the profiteers can have more. And the best part about it is you get we the people frustrated and angry and say, well, why can't they do anything? You know, kind of like I do here on the program every night. We talk about this all the time. And, you know, for me, it comes down to some simple stuff. We've got to get more involved. We've got to be willing to step up and say enough is enough. We've got to be willing to run for office. We've got to be willing to hold folks accountable. And listen to the Rick Smith Show. If you missed any portion of the program, RickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone, iTunes, all of that. You can also email me anytime, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg. It's the Rick Smith Show on...
You're listening to Win
Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. During Chicago's polar vortex, January 28th, that sent temperatures plunging below zero and closed schools, Rihanna and Rochat faced a dilemma. The single mom and Whole Foods worker had to scramble to find child care for her special needs child and was unable to do so. So she called off work to care for her child. Whole Foods fired her. On Wednesday in Chicago, the Workers' Organizing Committee of Chicago demanded that Whole Foods give Rihanna and her job back. The Chicago Teachers Union and community supporters held a strike protest at Whole Foods on Halstead Street, demanding Whole Foods reinstate Rihanna. Teachers Union President Karen Lewis says while companies like Whole Foods profess family values, they don't really act in support of those values. Lewis says you don't fire people for taking care of their children in inclement weather. The International Transport Workers Federation, ITF, is launching a global campaign for a fight for gender justice and safety for women transport workers. The action plan was started at a conference of ITF women transport workers in India. Diana Holland is chair of the ITF's Women's Committee and Assistant General Secretary of Unite in the UK. She says this campaign is a pragmatic effort to give women transport workers the support they need.
What we know is that we are not isolated, we're not on our own, and we can try and take on some of these forces that are affecting us internationally, that are affecting us in our workplaces. We can stand together and say we're not going to have women at the forefront of bearing the brunt of the crisis or the measures that are being taken in order to deal with it, and we're not going to have any transport workers treated the way that they are in some workplaces, some industry, some sector, some parts of our sector. And all of us are saying it's bottom line here. We're not going to be the race to the bottom, we're going to be the race to the top.
The ITF's Alison McGarry says the themes of the ITF conference stem from practical conditions that women transport workers are facing and the power of unified action to address them.
Fighting against violence against women comes from the sisters' experience. It feeds into our work program and into the day-to-day work that our affiliates are undertaking. It's really practical. It's about the sisters who are organizers talking about their experiences.
The audio used in this report is courtesy of Radio Labor. Republican governors and state lawmakers in 24 states are blocking 5 million low-income Americans from getting insurance coverage through Medicaid. MoveOn.org and other progressive organizations are pushing to get Medicaid coverage expanded to those states. In December, Iowa Republican Governor Terry Branstad decided to expand Medicaid coverage, and Utah Republican Governor Gary Herbert followed suit recently. 9 Republican governors have expanded Medicaid. All over the country, activists are calling on GOP leaders to stop blocking Medicaid health care coverage for the 5 million people who qualify but can't get it because Republicans are refusing to expand it in states that they control.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So much going on. You know, in the aftermath of the governor's big speech on Tuesday, lots of comments about, you know, the campaign speech, how much money we've spent promoting a horrible budget, $1 billion taken out of public education each of the last 3 years. And now he's trickled a little bit back in. I'm telling you, I won't fall for it. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. I've got Bob Ney, Talk News Service. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. Always nice to be on your show.
So the next hostage situation, which I've been waiting for, you know, because I've been jonesing. You know, when can we take the country to the brink of disaster again? Oh, tell me it's coming again.
Well, I don't think it is. I think it's done. We're going to have to find our excitement somewhere else, I think. You know, remember Speaker Boehner, the Republican Speaker, had said after 16 days, shut the government down, then he turned around and did nothing, put everything back, which he could have done 16 days before. And he told his constituency, you know, the Tea Party, and kept his members calm by saying, hey, our fight's on the debt ceiling. That's where our fight is. Well, the debt ceiling's coming up by the end of February. Everybody is saying, you know, that's got to be it or we're going to be in economic chaos. And the Republicans came out of their retreat. Now, the speaker himself, John Boehner, he did want some kind of deal. Don't get me wrong. He did. He wanted something. He didn't want to go through what he went through with the shutdown. But, Rick, it ends up that they're all over the place. They have no agreement amongst each other. So I think that the president utilizes this and says, no, no deal. Uh-uh. We're not attaching this. We're not attaching Keystone. We're not doing anything. and Boehner will yield to that, and this should be the final nail in the coffin. I don't think we're going to go on to the brink of anything with the debt ceiling again. I think we're back to the days of George Bush when we all voted for it about six times, yawned, and went to dinner.
Right. No, I mean, because, look, I mean, the numbers are what they are. I've been following the debt. The deficit numbers are coming down. It looks like we're heading into a more positive direction. Why throw things into chaos by having these debt fights and having these hostage situations when it appears to me that things seem to, at least on our deficits, seem to be coming down? Now, it's still too high in my view, but it's coming downward. And, you know, our debt-to-GDP ratio seems to be coming a little bit further down. You know, it just seems kind of silly to me.
That, and on top of it, besides that, you know, logical argument, they are coming down. The debt ceiling is paying for votes, put it this way, votes that the Congress has already cast.
Right.
They set this budget, whether the Republicans liked it or not, they voted for it,
yep.
Or they continued it, or they adjusted it, or they revised it. And so this is just paying for that.
It's like
when we were there and Bush was president, I can remember voting six times on it, and nobody said a word.
Yeah, I look at it as, you know, you like any one of us, you, me, anybody, we run up our credit card, and then you know, say, well, I don't want to pay for what I had yesterday. I mean, it's basically what they're saying. And I don't want to pay for last night's meal. You know, I saw this interesting article, and I don't know if you saw this article by Pat Buchanan, titled "How the GOP Lost Middle America."
I like Buchanan's statements a lot. I like his trade statement.
Exactly. I mean, I think we're on the same. When the economic stuff we're in, I think we're probably on the same page with. My problem with him is, you know, you get into the immigration, you get into some of the really outlier stuff. That's where he goes off the path. But you know, on the economic stuff, he was spot on. He said, you know, he said, you know, how did this happen? You know, he goes into this how they lost this. He said, you know, at the end of the Cold War, you know, he goes back and he looks at that, says, you know, the Republicans had this fork in the road where, you know, they had to decide which way they were going to go. Were they going to stand with middle America, or were they going to get into the back pockets of corporate America? And he points out that the Fortune 500 wanted to close factories in the U.S. and ship production abroad where unions did not exist, regulations were light, taxes were low, and wages were a fraction of what they were in the U.S. Corporate America was going global, and they wanted to get rid of its American workforce, the best paid on earth, and replace it with cheap foreign labor. He says, while manufacturing sought to move production abroad, hotels, motels, bars, restaurants, farms, construction companies all replaced their workers with people coming into the country. And he says, you know, while manufacturing sought to move production abroad and do all of these things, the Republicans, thanks to the Republicans, corporate America got everything they wanted. They got to ship their jobs overseas, and they got to bring in cheap labor from overseas to do the jobs that were here. And, you know, I couldn't agree with him more on that.
It's just hearing this stirs so many emotions because I watched it. I was there with the World Trade vote. I voted against it. Dennis Kucinich and I did a press conference where we showed the products that were on shelves with dead birds, formaldehyde in them, needles in teddy bears, you know, all from China. And of course, they poisoned the toys. And no matter what we did, you know, the large corporations got in there, got the votes, and then they told people, we just want to sell, you know, one product to each Chinese person. No, they wanted to make them over there.
Yep.
And then Senator Portman from Ohio, my home state, just a week ago said, we have to compete in the global market. The only way, Rick, you know this, we can do it is to create slave labor here. That's the only way you can compete with the slave labor in China. And I don't think we're
going to
do that.
Yeah, or we completely mechanize everything and we make human beings redundant. Because, you know, a lot of the manufacturing I'm seeing coming back, Bob, is all stuff that we're giving huge subsidies to these companies, and they're mechanizing it, so there's really no workers.
I heard an article, I should call propaganda, the other day on TV, and they were talking about the you know, the new business tools, blah, blah, blah. And I listened further and then went and Googled, and what it ended up is they were bragging about creating jobs for robots.
Yep.
That's what they were bragging about.
And I keep asking people, what's 20 years from now look like? Because I think it was Thomas Friedman that wrote a piece not too long ago, and I'm not a huge Friedman fan, but he wrote a piece that said like half of the jobs that we have today, half of the jobs that we're doing today in 20 years are going to be mechanized. So what happens in 20 years as the population continues to grow, as we continue to, you know demographically we're going to grow, what happens if the jobs continue to shrink and the population continues to grow? What happens to this country economically? And then not beyond that, you know, from a democratic standpoint, when then you have all of the control into the hands of the very few.
It is scary. The aftermath would be really chaotic. Really bad.
And, you know, I look at this fight over the extending very short period of time, the unemployment benefits, who, you know, I've talked to several workers here recently who have said, you know, it's horrible. You know, I can't find a job. Send out hundreds of resumes, had hundreds of phone interviews, and I spent hours and hours and hours going through interview processes only to be turned down. And I'm going, for 3 short months, we're going through this whole process? Are you kidding me?
I know a man who was in management in the company. I talked to him today. Very, very skilled, very smart. He is having a hard time. I'm talking about getting labor, a job with pushing a broom somewhere. He's having a hard time.
Yeah.
Went everywhere, you know, put out over 100 resumes. So there's people like that all over the country, and they need the unemployment. Now, the unemployment vote, which they're trying to do for tomorrow, in the Senate, Harry Reid said to the Republicans, you want 3 months? I'll give you 3 months. Now, he'd like to have had more, but he said, I'll give you 3 months. You want it paid for? I'll pay for it. He's come up with a way to, what they call smoothing some pensions. So he's given them what they wanted. But what was the quote from Sessions?
It's immoral.
Immoral. So that's his quote. That's how far they're going to get with him. You know, but the Republicans did get what they wanted in the Senate. So I don't know if they'll give the cloture vote, you know, the 60 votes they need to bring a bill to the floor. They'll be part of that. It'll be very interesting to see tomorrow how they would justify not supporting the extension that they asked for in this manner, in this form.
Well, here again, you know, you can never give enough. And this is what I've been saying for the longest time. It's never enough. You give what they want, and they want more. Look at Obamacare. I mean, you understand this. Obamacare was basically what the Republicans wanted when Hillary came out with her plan. This was the alternative to the Hillary plan, the Hillary plan, and now it wasn't enough?
Well, I think the president learned about, you know, making a deal on certain things.
Yeah.
Yeah, but back, really, when it gets some of his philosophy, I think pretty well early on, because he thought he could get some arrangements. Well,
saw an interesting report from the CBO saying that they're going to lose because of the Affordable Care Act, and the right's jumped all over this. It's a job killer. We know it's a job killer. See, saying that's what, I guess 2.5 million jobs, they're saying could be a lost because of the Affordable Care Act.
2.5 million people, up to, over a period of time, could opt out of their current jobs or reduce their hours because they're getting health care. And the only reason they were working certain jobs, barely making it, was for the health care component. So now they could. That doesn't mean they won't start a home business.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they won't work somewhere else after they leave their job. But some in the media took that, and the headline all across the country came out that Obamacare was going to put them out of that job. These are people who would voluntarily leave that. Now, some people might look at it a little bit different, and I was doing some radio today where one of the comments was, you know, maybe some of these people need to leave their job. If they get the health care and they've been working a really bad job, but they've been doing it just to get the health care for a child who, you know, is ill. If they get the health care, maybe it'll give them a stimulus to be at home to help out the child, maybe, you know, again, start a home business, and they're not having to fork out $1,500 a month right now for health care that they use.
Or maybe it just opens up jobs for other people who would want them. I mean, I know a couple of people who don't need the money. They need the health care. They're doing this job. They don't need the job. They don't want the job. It's, hey, I got to go because it's cheap health care. And that's the only reason.
All the time. There are hundreds of thousands of people
across the United States that will take certain jobs when they could take another job because they don't have health care. Now, if they have health care, they have mobility, they can take, you know, the other job maybe that they wanted in the first place.
Or they could just get out
There's
of the
a lot
workforce.
Of ways to look at this.
Or they could just get out of the workforce entirely, which I'm not against. If they voluntarily move out of the workforce, I'm okay with that. Get them the health care that they need so that they can live their lives. If they can afford to pay their bills without having to go to a job and they've got health, I'm okay with that. I think that's where we eventually want to get to, a place where, you know, if you got people who are going to voluntarily leave the workforce so people who don't, 23 million people who don't have jobs can get one, I'm in favor of that.
It'll be interesting. I mean, the report stirred all kinds of reactions, and again, headlines were created on their own. But you have to, you know, it's like anything in Washington. You know that, Rick. You have to analyze what on earth you're hearing.
Yeah.
That's why you're on the air to do that. So.
Yep, that's the point. Bob, always great talking with you, man.
Sure.
Appreciate the time. Bob Nay, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Albert Klein. Many conservatives lashed out at Coca-Cola for their Super Bowl advertisement featuring a multilingual rendition of America the Beautiful. On The Five, Fox host Eric Bolling complained.
For whatever you gain in this diversity thing that you're going for, Coke, you blew it with a lot of people who are very, very patriotic about that song. About that song.
But anchorwoman Brenda Wood of WXIA in Atlanta demolished these myths in her segment, Brenda's Last Word.
But the fact that people are outraged over this ad is outrageous itself. People indignant that others would have the audacity to sing America the Beautiful in a language other than English when America was built on opening its arms to the world. The quote on the Statue of Liberty doesn't say, give me your English-speaking only Christian-believing heterosexual masses. It says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, tempest-tossed.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
The funny thing about Wall Street banksters is that they make a killing by defrauding millions of homeowners, customers, investors, and taxpayers. Then, when caught, they wonder why we don't love them. That's funny, as in bizarre, not as in ha-ha. Still, it's hard not to laugh at Jamie Dimon, the vainglorious silver-haired boss of the J.P. Morgan Chase House of Banksters. Last year alone, the bank racked up a record level of regulatory fines for the recidivist criminal operation overseen by the boss. A little self-reproachment might have done him some good, but Dimon chose a funny way, again meaning bizarre, to express remorse. He's been running a Feel Sorry for Me campaign, claiming that he's the victim of this sordid story. Never mind his long rap sheet of malfeasance and incompetence, which cost so many so much. Jamie wails that everything from Wall Street's bailout to the pay of top bank executives have made people envious of bankers' success. Thus, he moans, an anti-Wall Street sentiment has spread through the public, prompting politicians and regulators to pander to this populist anger by persecuting enterprising bankers like him. He called the whole thing, quote, unfair. Good grief. This guy bills bank profits through rip-offs, piles billions of dollars in fines on the backs of shareholders, pockets $20 million in personal pay for 1 year's work, and he wants us to weep for him? Being a Wall Street boss, you see, means never having to say you're sorry, for it's always someone else's fault. This is Jim Hightower saying, only 25 years ago, more than 1,000 bankers were prosecuted for this sort of malfeasance during the savings and loan scandal. Let's return to the ethical accountability of those days. Or maybe we the people should send our own message to today's banksters by rolling a guillotine down the center of Wall Street.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Anyway,
Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at therickssmithshow.com. So, you know, the governor gave his big speech on Tuesday, and I'm sure a lot of people saw it. Not so many. But I'm sure we read the reports about it. And, you know, the sad reality is all across the country, governors who had these austerity budgets, you know, have now turned it around. Our governor, not so much. This was an election. Understand, this was an election budget. This was his attempt to say, hey, look, you know, I'm spreading things around. But you look at the reality, and it's more of the same. It was bad light. Still bad, but bad light. He did make the funny ha-ha. You know, it's your last call on the wine and spirit shops. Going to go after that. And I look at it and I go, you know, at some point, are we going to go, you know, enough of the privatization? I look at this lawmaker in Nebraska, Amanda McGill. She's a state senator there in Nebraska. She's proposing that, and this is something that, you know, I think just as common sense, that the state of Nebraska will not, as a matter of contract, in fact, it'll make it illegal as a matter of a contract for the state of Nebraska to promise to keep the prisons full. Because, you know, in these privatization schemes, you know, you love to hear the right talk about competition and private sector and duking it out, and because you think that, you know, it's like a boxing match. You know, and they're really going to, they're going to be fit and lean, and they're going to cut costs, and they're going to do all of this streamlining, and they do, but they still pocket the money. They cut the wages, they cut the benefits, they cut the staffing, they cut. Cost we, the taxpayers, the same, but someone sits at the top fat and happy. And when they negotiate these contracts, what I love about them is that there's a minimum requirement. You're going to promise that you're going to keep throwing people in jail so we can keep charging you for them. The idea of heads in beds. And, you know, you look at the drug laws. Number of states are decriminalizing or legalizing marijuana. The private for-profit industry of prisons, they've got to be going, whoa, that's our profit margin. You're locking those people up who aren't really hard to manage. They're not really going to get, you know, too ambitious. You're going to take them out of our prisons? Well, what will we do for profits? Well, according to the state senator, she's going to make it illegal for them to do it. And, you know, you've got these contracts with companies like Correction Corporations of America who have certain minimum occupancy levels that the state has promised. And what she points out is one such lockup quota appears in two-thirds of all of the prison privatization contracts, which is put forth by the folks in the public interest who we have on the program quite often. And, you know, it's about time. I mean, I'm of the mindset that maybe we should be looking at the insane policies of locking people up and not educating them. According to the one statistic I saw, it costs 2.5 times to lock someone up as it costs to send them to school. And you want to talk about this, you know, this prison, this cradle to prison pipeline? This is what we've done to our inner cities. And it's ludicrous on a number of levels. But you understand, when they sign these contracts, when we go down this route, it's about them putting money in their pocket, which is what scares me about the liquor privatization. Another thing. Now, the governor has said it's last call on state-owned liquor. And I'm of the mindset, I don't know anybody who wants that. I know the governor and a number of Republicans do, but I don't know actual people. I don't know many citizens that want it. Because I think we all understand that there are a bunch of societal problems that come with having liquor everywhere. If you can buy a bottle of Jack next to the Tic Tacs on the way out of the gas station, Pennsylvania has one of the lowest rates of fatalities because of drunk driving accidents in the country. And there's a reason for that. That people are more responsible. And I think when it's not an impulse item, people are more responsible. Look, if I want a bottle of whatever it is, vodka, whiskey, you know, scotch, whatever. Occasionally I do partake. I'm a fan of Crown Royal. I'm a fan of a number of I like vodka and gin. I was a Tanqueray guy for years. When I want those things, I know where it is. I don't want it being peddled everywhere. Now, what's interesting to me is what people actually want, and I'm not horribly against, is the idea that you can buy a six-pack in the grocery store. I think that's what people really want. But that's what the Republicans aren't willing to give. So what's interesting to me, and listen, my Republican friends, it may sound like I'm beating you guys up. I'm not. I'm beating up the insanity that is the leadership of your party. Nobody really wants liquor privatization. Nobody wants Jack in the grocery store. Nobody wants Tanqueray or any of the other things in the gas station. People simply want to be able to buy a six-pack or a couple of wine coolers every now and again. Now, the people who fund Republican campaigns, the beer distributors and the bar association, the tavern association, if you will, the people who have a stranglehold on the beer, the private sector, which I love. I love the idea that they don't seem to mind that there's a monopoly there's a monopoly here in Pennsylvania with the beer in the private sector. Don't mind that. But the liquor that nobody really seems to have a problem with, that's a huge, huge problem. And it's something that we have to have last call on. I see this report in Oregon. Now, Oregon, they're the chairman of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. He delivered a speech on Friday. He said the state certainly has been static for a long period of time. He said he wants to go and privatize their wine and spirit shop. He says it can't be a win-win for everyone. The interests are too diverse. He claims the prices are going to jump. You're going to have hundreds of these locally owned liquor stores and these fledgling craft distilleries. They're going to be crushed. Because understand what happens. Here in Pennsylvania, you have a bunch of wineries that are popping up, a bunch of microbrews, a bunch of, small little startups. When the big boxes get a hold of beer, you're going to get what I got in Florida. Very simple. You're going to get what I got in Florida. You got about 10 choices of beer. You got 2 choices of wine cooler. And a couple of bottles of wine. It was what was on the aisle. You go across the street to the other grocery store. There's about 10 different kinds of beer, mostly your big national brands, nothing local, nothing obscure, mostly things that have huge advertising budgets and pay for shelf space. And that's your choice. There aren't mom and pops around. There's none of that stuff there because they get crushed because they can't afford to buy space and have inventory. And what happens is you end up having these huge mega stores, these huge chains that control your distribution, and they saturate. And their buying power is so large that mom and pop never going to compete. Not going to happen. And what then happens is, all of those craft beers, all of the microbrews, all of those other things, they never see the light of a shelf. And you go back and you think about Yingling, which everyone seems to love Yingling. I'm not a big fan of Dick. Yingling is a guy who's in this state trying to push right to work, which I think is a huge, enormous, massive mistake. But for his narrow self-interest, if he can deny his workers the ability to collectively bargain, that means more money in his pocket. If it weren't for his ability to put his product on Pennsylvania's shelves, you go back a number of years, he was basically broke. It was that new product. It was that new, I forget what it was. It was I forget what the beer was, but it was one of those things that you didn't get wide distribution. If you've got a setup where you got the big national brands and that's it, does he survive? The answer is no. So when I look at this whole privatization scheme, more bad ideas. More of the same, and more of you and me, the taxpayer, getting screwed. And I keep asking, what is it? Please. Pretty simple. What is it that we've privatized? What is it that we've handed off to private for-profit special interest that we used to do for ourselves that is actually better for us, that's actually worked out better, costs us less with better service. I look at the parking authority in Harrisburg. It ain't it. So that's really kind of the question. And you look at this and you go down the road. Are we going to continue the same bad ideas, down the same bad path? And sadly, I think the answer is yes, because the big money special interests, they're the ones who are advertising. And understand, with the liquor privatization, the newspapers, they're on board too. Why? Advertisement money. Tons of it. The radio, TV, all of them in favor of it. Because, hey, advertisers, big money coming in. Print, yeah, the print media, they want it like no other. Because there's a huge advertising budget that goes into these things. And again, I go back to what the old man always said. You know, if a rich guy's going to spend a buck to tell you don't need something, you better spend two to get it. So if all of this money, all of this energy, all of this time is spent telling us you don't need that asset that is yours. You don't need that those wine and spirit shops. No, you don't need that. We better be fighting to hold on to it. Because the moneyed interests, they know a gold mine when they see it. And if they're spending this kind of money to go after it, well, you better damn well believe it's worth a lot more than they want us to believe. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the top.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. During Chicago's polar vortex January 28th that sent temperatures plunging below zero and closed schools, Rihanna and Broshat faced a dilemma. The single mom and Whole Food worker had to scramble to find child care for her special needs child and was unable to do so. So she called off work to care for her child. Whole Foods fired her. On Wednesday in Chicago, the Workers' Organizing Committee of Chicago demanded that Whole Foods give Rihanna her job back. The Chicago Teachers Union and community supporters held a strike protest at Whole Foods on Halsted Street, demanding Whole Foods reinstate Rihanna. Teachers Union President Karen Lewis says while companies like Whole Foods profess family values, they don't really act in support of those values. Lewis says you don't fire people for taking care of their children in inclement weather. The International Transport Workers Federation, ITF, is launching a global campaign for a fight for gender justice and safety for women transport workers. The action plan was started at a conference of ITF women transport workers in India. Diana Holland is chair of the ITF's Women's Committee and Assistant General Secretary of Unite in the UK. She says this campaign is a pragmatic effort to give women transport workers the support they need.
What we know is that we are not isolated, we're not on our own, and we can try and take on some of these forces that are affecting us internationally, that are affecting us in our workplaces. We can stand together and say we're not going to have women at the forefront of bearing the brunt of the crisis or the measures that are being taken in order to deal with it, and we're not going to have any transport workers treated the way that they are in some workplaces, some industry, some sector, some parts of our sector. And all of us are saying this bottom line here, we're not going to be the race to the bottom, we're going to be the race to the top.
The ITF's Ellison McGarry says the themes of the ITF conference stem from practical conditions that women transport workers are facing and the power of unified action to address them.
Fighting against violence against women comes from the sisters' experience. It feeds into our work program and into the day-to-day work that our affiliates are undertaking. It's really practical. It's about the sisters who are organizers talking about their experiences.
The audio used in this report is courtesy of Radio Labor. Republican governors and state lawmakers in 24 states are blocking 5 million low-income Americans from getting insurance coverage through Medicaid. MoveOn.org and other progressive organizations are pushing to get Medicaid coverage expanded to those states. In December, Iowa Republican Governor Terry Branstad decided to expand Medicaid coverage, and Utah Republican Governor Gary Herbert followed suit recently. 9 Republican governors have expanded Medicaid. All over the country, activists are calling on GOP leaders to stop blocking Medicaid
Medicaid health care coverage for the 5 million people who qualify but can't get it because Republicans are refusing to expand it in states that they control.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Yes, Pussy Riot, that's what it is. Yes, the wonderful, sensational group from Russia. Big news today, though, was Samantha Powers, the ambassador, tweeted out that she would join Pussy Riot for the first concert in Russia for political prisoners. And you got to kind of wonder how the Obama administration is going to feel about that. Let's find out. Let's go to Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on. Ellen, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you so much. Lots going on, and the Pussy Riot thing is just one piece coming out of the State Department today, and it is true that she tweeted this out, Samantha Powers. But then there's a story later on going, which is that somebody was able to tap in and listen to a conversation between the former spokesperson, Victoria Nuland, who is now the assistant secretary, and our ambassador to Ukraine. And she used the F word, but she also says things about the European Union and their lack of leadership, to say the least, on the Ukraine issue. And that is what is the back and forth that is going on, and somebody taped it, and then the Russians were first out of the box to tweet that it was on YouTube. Well, I wonder how it got to YouTube.
Interesting.
A private conversation between two members of our State Department?
Well, I mean, in this day and age, I was just having this conversation with my daughter. All of those things that I read, all the sci-fi books that I read as a kid, that stuff's reality. I mean, you've got this little thing in your pocket that I don't care what anyone says. They can tap into any time they want, listen to whatever you're saying, wherever you're saying it, and there's no such thing as privacy anymore, in my view.
Well, there isn't any privacy, and I've told our staff, don't do or say anything you wouldn't want on the front page of the New York Times.
Or say a whole bunch of things to get yourself on the front page of the New York Times.
Right.
One or the other. But, at the end of it, it comes down to, our State Department, the folks there, Maybe we should be thinking about what we're saying out loud.
Well, yes, but it's interesting that this went this way, that we're not very happy with the European Union, and that leaked out. I mean, it's just, you can't make this stuff up.
I guess there's part of me that goes, maybe having more openness will make us better people.
Well, I think so. I mean, I think our government should be more open. But I think the other thing that we just have got to realize is that any communication you have can be tapped, will be tapped, will find itself somewhere. And unless you're doing it in the privacy of your bedroom with your husband or wife, you better expect that it's going to go somewhere.
Well, I'm already expecting that that's already happened. Even in the privacy of your own bedroom, I'm sure that's happening. You go back to the days of J. Edgar Hoover. I mean, especially back then, they were tapping people's bedrooms.
Well, that's for sure. And as you know, of course, there's those Martin Luther King tapes.
Yeah, which they say wasn't actually him.
What do you mean it wasn't actually him?
I just watched a special on that the other day with the whole anniversary of the assassination and all that.
Right.
And they said it actually wasn't him. It was one of his staff people. He wasn't even in the room.
Really?
That's the story that has now come out, that it wasn't actually him. It was one of these.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Look, I don't care if it was or it wasn't. what happens between two consenting adults in the confines of their four walls is their business.
I agree with you.
That's the least of my problems. I'm worried about what people do outside of the bedroom that's doing to me what should be done inside the bedroom every day.
Ha, ha, ha. Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, look at today, for instance. We could not get a simple, very simple, paid-for, short-term unemployment extension done. And I don't even know why you can't get this done. Everyone knows it's a stimulus. Everyone knows that there are three people looking for every one job that's out there. Pulling this money out of the economy is a horrible idea. But still, couldn't get it done.
I know. And, you know, obviously, they could only get four Republicans to go along with this. And you know the House would have objected to it. And they're cutting off their nose to spite their face. But, you know, they have this little part of the party that they feel they have to address.
It's just insane to me. And, you know, the part that gets me, Alan, is, you know, we can't do this very short-term thing, yet I look at our trade deficit with China. You want to actually do something to get people back to work? I've got a really good idea. Why don't we start reeling in the horrible trade policies we've got with the rest of the world? I just saw the numbers out today. Last year, another record, $318 billion we shipped from this country to China, and they used to, oh, I don't know, buy us. Not our products, but buy us.
Well, that's right. And they only did bought $13 billion worth of products from us last month. It was a 40% increase in the trade deficit with China last year. I mean, $319 billion is the trade deficit. That's insane.
And now what I say, keep saying, look, what if we had that $319 billion worth of products made here? Those people had those jobs here. Because what's interesting to me is, you know, to me, and I don't know if you saw the Pat Buchanan piece. I'm generally not a Buchanan fan, but on his trade policy and on some of the economic stuff, I think he's right. And he pointed it out. Look, you know, the Republicans back in the 80s and 90s, they gave away the baby with the bathwater when they you know, cozied up to corporate America and gave them everything they wanted, which is why they're losing middle America, and they should have lost middle America years ago if we had half a brain.
Yes, I agree with you on that one.
Well, you can't agree with me because I'm not wrong.
Well, right, okay.
I understand today was the National Day of Prayer.
It was, and the president had a prayer breakfast. You know, not terribly unexpected. By the way, Ronald Reagan was also 103 today if you were on the planet.
Yep.
The president did talk about religious freedom. He particularly also talked about Kenneth Bay, the guy who is in North Korea, sent for 15 years, talked about another man whose name escapes me, but this is a guy in Iran that nobody's heard from,
right.
Talked about how people have to pray when the guards aren't looking in jail. Was very, very eloquent on that particular topic.
Yeah, and, you know, for all of the talk I hear from the religious extreme right in this country, how they're being persecuted, that's being persecuted. The fact that you can't hang the Ten Commandments, plaster them everywhere, is not persecution. In fact, I'm a big supporter, and I've asked this question of just about everybody who advocates for plastering the Ten Rules everywhere, just to name them to me. And if they can name them to me, I'm like, well, what's the point of having them hung up? You know them. What I find,
right.
Invariably what I find is the people who want them hung everywhere, they can't remember them. So they need the constant reminder to just be a decent human being.
I love that.
It just is what it is. You know, I had the good pastor James David Manning on the program a couple of years back. And you would think a pastor would be able to just rattle them right off, right? No, he wanted to go to the Bible and read them to me. And I'm saying, no, I don't want you to read them to me. I don't doubt that you can read. I doubt that you understand your 10 little rules.
What did he say?
He wanted to read them, and he would not tell me what they were. And I'm going, oh, just tell me in simple words, honest, human, decent, just tell me the words. And he wanted to go back and read, and it devolved from there. But I understand the president met with the Haitian president.
Yes, we don't really have a full readout at this point of what they talked about. We do know that security is obviously one of them. The drug issue is another. I don't know if they talked about the viruses and the medical conditions. I'm sure that probably was on the table. And, of course, the recovery from the storm,
right.
From the earthquake, it is always on everybody's mind.
So the big news, the Olympics started. Hooray!
The Olympics started, and tomorrow night is the opening ceremony.
Of which I probably
I know
won't.
A lot of people. You're not going to watch it?
Probably not. I don't watch television.
I don't either, but I'm obsessed with the Olympics.
Yeah, my wife's the figure skating. You know, if I do watch something, it'll be the crashes from the bobsled and the luge. And the agony of defeat. I'm sure you remember the commercials, the intro to Wild World of Sports back in the 70s where the guy was going down that big jump and just wiped out. And it was horrible. But you couldn't watch. It was a train wreck. You had to watch. That's kind of what I'm interested in. And the hockey.
Oh, yeah.
And the hockey.
I like the opening ceremony.
Well, good. So it begins tomorrow. I understand that they're checking people's toothpaste. How are they doing that?
Well, you know, something that's a stupid thing and anybody who's been in the airline industry or transportation industry knows that you can't even do that, as you just pointed out. I mean, why is the press focusing on that?
Look, it goes back to what I said from the very beginning. And this has not changed. People who have listened to the program for years know I'm an advocate of people just flying naked. You're not allowed to bring anything. The seats are like the doctor's office. It has a little piece of paper, slide it over the seat, you sit on the little paper, you get off the plane, everyone gets dressed on the other side. Very simple. Now I don't know if
That would certainly end this kind of thing.
Maybe not, because you know, you listen to the Israelis and they keep saying, well, you know, you go through the porno scanners, go through all that stuff. We could bring things in, you know, wherever and still bring things down. Well, there's a will, there's a way. And you know, I'm of the mindset, you know, you can't be afraid of everything. It is what it is. And the other part of the Olympics, I guess.
And we don't know that they didn't put that out to warn people. I mean,
to scare people.
Not to scare people, but to also say, hey, you know, we're going to be looking at everything.
Yeah, don't bring toothpaste with you.
Right.
Forget that oral hygiene. You know, those teeth are bad for you anyway.
Ha ha.
Eat Twinkies. They're good and soft. But I understand they're shooting dogs. I thought I had heard something about this, but I guess there's a billionaire who's throwing some money into not shooting dogs?
Yes, he is. He's giving a lot of money to setting up an animal shelter, and they're bringing as many animals as they can into the shelter before the Olympics.
Yeah, I look at that and I go, you know, no wonder we didn't like the Russians.
Ha ha.
I guess Eric Cantor is finally coming up with a Republican alternative.
Well, he has to come up with a plan. They said there's some broad outlines of the plan, and his job is to fill it up.
Kind of late, don't you think?
Well, 2 years late, but hey, they're beginning to understand that they're going to be in debates in the 2014 elections, and they don't have the ability to win them.
Kind of late. I mean, people are already signing up for it. You can't now go back and say, oh, well, we're going to do something else and take this away from you. I guess they can.
They can try. Yeah. They're not going to succeed.
Sad, sad. I understand the Syrians, 4.1 million refugees by the end of the year?
4.1 million refugees by the end of this coming year. That's absolutely correct.
And we've loosened some of the restrictions for some folks to come here?
Well, we have, but very, very few. I mean, some countries are taking 30 people, 50 people, 100 people. Even we took 500. That's nothing.
And I understand Senator Kaine held a press conference on the survivors of the chemical attack?
Yes. I mean, basically he's saying that these people need to be able to get the help needed for refugees. We need to get more money, and we do. There's no question.
No, I'm with you. But why Senator? Okay, well, all right, good for him.
I mean, you know, certain things move certain people. Certain stories move certain people.
Yeah, and finally, a resolution regarding Afghanistan. What's that about?
Resolution is basically it's how we're going to get out and what we need to do. I didn't actually see the resolution, so I don't yet know what it contains, but it has a lot to do with sort of how are we going to maneuver out, how are we going to keep the troops that are there safe, you know, all that kind of stuff.
I'm of the mindset you just get out. Just start.
I'm
of the mindset you just get out.
Well,
start
there's
packing
actually nothing you can do. And we've talked to people in special forces. They say it's hopeless over there.
Yeah, just pack your stuff and go. I mean,
the Russians are willing to do lots of things that we're not willing to do, and they got out.
Yeah, exactly. And to me, I go back to that time and time again because the reality,
That's what brought their country to its knees. You can say all you want about Reagan and all of that. At the end of the day, it was 17 years of pouring money, making big rocks smaller.
Ha! Today is Mr. Reagan's 103rd birthday. Say happy birthday to your favorite person.
Happy birthday, Ronnie. But even Ronnie wasn't as extreme as the Republicans running his party today.
I was about to say, listen, compared to some of what's out there now, he looked pretty good.
Yeah, he didn't hate workers. He just didn't like them. These folks absolutely hate workers. Ellen, it's always great talking with you. Appreciate
Thank
the time.
You.
Ellen Ratner.
You got it.
Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show.
The funny thing about Wall Street banksters is that they make a killing by defrauding millions of homeowners, customers, investors, and taxpayers. Then, when caught, they wonder why we don't love them. That's funny as in bizarre, not as in ha-ha. Still, it's hard not to laugh at Jamie Dimon, the vainglorious silver-haired boss of the J.P. Morgan Chase House of Banksters. Last year alone, the bank racked up a record level of regulatory fines for the recidivist criminal operation overseen by the boss. A little self-reproachment might have done him some good, but Dimon chose a funny way, again meaning bizarre, to express remorse. He's been running a Feel Sorry for Me campaign, claiming that he's the victim of this sordid story. Never mind his long rap sheet of malfeasance and incompetence, which cost so many so much. Jamie wails that everything from Wall Street's bailout to the pay of top bank executives have made people envious of bankers' success. Thus, he moans, an anti-Wall Street sentiment has spread through the public, prompting politicians and regulators to pander to this populist anger by persecuting enterprising bankers like him. He called the whole thing, quote, unfair. Good grief. This guy builds bank profits through rip-offs, piles billions of dollars in fines on the backs of shareholders, pockets $20 million in personal pay for 1 year's work, and he wants us to weep for him? Being a Wall Street boss, you see, means never having to say you're sorry, for it's always someone else's fault. This is Jim Hightower saying, only 25 years ago, more than 1,000 bankers were prosecuted for this sort of malfeasance during the savings and loan scandal. Let's return to the ethical accountability of those days. Or maybe we the people should send our own message to today's banksters by rolling a guillotine down the center of Wall Street.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. You know, to go and look at the trade deficit thing, I mean, the numbers are just staggering. You think of, you know, this has just been in the last, you know, 15 years. The last 18 years that we've had these massive, staggering, the last 20 years that we've had these staggering trade deficits. NAFTA. You know, earlier in the program, you know, Tom had brought up that, wow, you only seem to go after Republicans. Well, no, I got a lot of problems with politicians as a whole. It seems that a lot of the really, really negative, destructive stuff came from Republicans. And the example that I was using of, you know, the CDL and the Patriot Act, both were Republicans. I mean, I can't help it. That's what is. But our trade deficits, you know, again, you know, you go back to the Reagan years, this push towards neoliberal trade, pushing towards H.W. Bush to fully negotiate NAFTA.
If you remember it, everybody, both parties were on board with it. It was Ross Perot who was saying, hey, we might want to think this through. You remember the John Second Sound? Remember that? We're going to hear John Second Sound. I do. I remember it quite clearly, and it's one of the reasons that I had seriously considered at the time voting for Perot. Then, you know, like a lot of things, you know, he seemed to take this really bizarre turn. You know, the Black Panthers were coming to capture his daughters, and you know, a whole bunch of weird kind of weird stuff. But on trade, again, very right. So you look at now, you know, NAFTA was a horrible idea. We now look back on that, or most thoughtful people, I think, look back on it and go, yeah, NAFTA was a bad idea. Just a really, really bad idea. And then you go to all of the other stuff, you know, the GATS, the WTOs, all of the stuff, the pushing towards the free trade of the Americas, pushing for CORUS and pushing for Panama and Colombia, and now this Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Understand, you know, our trade deficit this past year, $318.4 billion. $318.4 billion. Our trade deficit in non-petroleum products. Now, this isn't our oil trade deficit. That's something completely different. Our goods trade deficit, just the stuff we buy, just the stuff we put in our homes and the products that we buy, we had a trade deficit of $456.4 billion. Almost $500 billion, up from last year's $338 billion. Now, with other countries, it seems to be coming down a little bit, but with China, man, it jumped again. So you're looking at another record year. And this year looks to be another record year. And you keep asking yourself, at what point do we, kind of stop and say enough's enough? Our trade deficit in goods and services actually came down a little bit because our service sector, the Wall Street people, well, the trade agreements helped them. And in fact, in 2012, we had a $534.7 billion trade deficit in goods and services. That went down to $471 billion. So the service sector, the Wall Street folks, the financial institutions, the banksters, they're doing well at the expense of the rest of us. Now, what I keep saying is what we need to have is we need to have an actual trade policy. Do you know since 2009, our trade deficit has gone up by 40%? Think about this. In the next 5 years, it goes up another 40%. Think about this. Scary, scary times, folks. How many jobs will we lose? And to me, it comes down to we're just not holding them accountable with what few rules are there. Now, for me, I keep saying we need to have leaders with a backbone. The currency manipulation, that's a huge thing. But if you want to start creating jobs, if you want an economy that works, you got to start with trade. That simple. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone, iTunes as well. You can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And, I enjoy the interaction. Thanks for being here. Appreciate the time. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tidal flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the